Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The gay rights movement is changing everything.
The Pentagon announced new rules today allowing transgender military members to serve openly. It follows a pledge from President Biden just days into his administration, restoring an Obama-era policy that was overturned by his successor, President Trump. The NewsHour's Ali Rogan spoke to transgender service members who've been waiting for this day.
When Navy Lieutenant Commander Emily Schilling visits this retired warplane known as a Prowler, it's like seeing an old friend.
She's tried to kill me. She's saved my life. She's been there on some of my scariest moments.
Schilling's been in the Navy 15 years, most of them as a pilot, with more than 1,700 flight hours and 60 combat missions in Iraq and Afghanistan. For a long time, the cockpit was the only place she could be herself.
Somebody once asked me, did I ever fly as trans? Did I ever fly as M? We're the same person. I am always M. I always have been.
For most of her life, Schilling was known as Timothy. She came out as transgender in April 2019, 2 days after President Donald Trump reinstated a ban on people like her serving openly.
I spent the first 36 years of my life trying to figure this out and fight it. And I just got to the point where I couldn't fight it anymore, and I had to do something.
Now, outside of work at a naval air base in Maryland, Schilling can be herself. But while she waited for the new policy to take effect, she had to wear a facade, presenting mail and wearing her gender-neutral flight suit daily.
You play this hyper-masculine role, and then come home and turn it off. It's exhausting.
In 2016, President Barack Obama declared that being transgender was no longer grounds for dismissal. The military began covering gender-affirming health care, like hormones and surgery, announced then-Secretary of Defense Ash Carter.
I'm announcing today that we're ending the ban on transgender Americans in the United States military.
Schilling had been coming to terms with her gender identity during the Obama administration, but it wasn't the right time for her to come out. Then in 2017, a new policy from a new president. In a tweet, President Trump said the military would no longer allow transgender people to serve. Those who received coverage during the Obama administration could keep serving openly, but all others would have to serve in their sex assigned at birth. By the time Schilling was ready to transition, the political winds had shifted.
So you had a time period where people were allowed to be open and serve. And then when the ban went into place, you had a second class of people who came out too late and now had to go back into the closet.
Transgender service members have been on a complete roller coaster ride over the past 5 years.
Air Force Lieutenant Colonel Bree Fram is a vice president of SPARTA, a transgender military advocacy group. Her group advised on the Obama change, supported members through the Trump repeal, and is helping the Biden White House lift restrictions. Under the Obama policy, transgender service members could access care following a diagnosis of gender dysphoria, the medical term for when a person's gender identity differs from their sex at birth. 1,600 service members were covered under this policy. The Defense Department does not keep statistics on its transgender population, but independent estimates count between 5,000 to 15,000 currently serving out of about 2 million total active duty and reserve forces.
They're just in a situation where they have to dedicate energy to hiding themselves. And that's energy that could otherwise be used to go towards mission effectiveness.
Some opponents say trans members shouldn't be part of the mission at all. Retired Army Lieutenant General Thomas Spohr is the director of the Conservative Heritage Foundation's Center for National Defense. He pointed to high rates of severe anxiety and suicide among people diagnosed with gender dysphoria.
Frankly, the military is very discriminatory in its entrance criteria. And so if you have asthma, if you have severe depression, you can't join the military. Not allowing someone with gender dysphoria to not enter the military is the same type of thing.
But numerous studies show that depression among people with gender dysphoria is linked to society's treatment of them, including discrimination, family rejection, and lack of access to gender-affirming health care. In fact, the impact the Trump ban had on the mental health of trans people extended beyond the military. The Trevor Project, an organization supporting LGBTQ youth, said calls to its crisis line more than doubled following Trump's 2017 tweet. Amit Paley is CEO and executive director.
When the president of the United States sends a message that trans people are not deserving of respect, that has an impact on the mental health of all trans and non-binary people.
The new policy doesn't just affect transgender people who are currently serving. It also opens the door to those who have wanted to join the military but have been waiting.
People like 23-year-old Kaysen Bradley, who wants to join the Army.
It's really exciting.
Bradley began his female-to-male transition, graduated high school, and tried to enlist right as Trump was changing the policy. But rather than give up, Bradley dug in. Biding his time, he built himself into a better recruit.
I had to think, you know, it's not going to be forever. There's going to be a time where the policy changes.
Bree Fram hopes this time the change is for good.
After four more years of open service, we firmly believe that a military without transgender people will be just as unconscionable as a military without African Americans, without women, or without lesbians, gays, and bisexuals, because they all faced some very similar hurdles to what trans people faced.
Meanwhile, Schilling is awaiting guidance for when she can move forward.
When I go see my friends, when I go shopping, when I'm hanging out with my kids, I present as Emily. Now I can begin that process with the Navy.
And soon she'll be able to officially reintroduce herself to the Prowler as who she really is. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Allie Rogan in Patuxent River, Maryland.
Why haven't you learned anything?
School attendance for years has been a major indicator of whether students are staying on track. And this year, during the pandemic, WBEZ found that schools serving large numbers of low-income students tended to dip in attendance. That's been a red flag for these districts, as WBEZ's Susie Ahn reports.
The pandemic changed everything for a lot of kids in suburban North Chicago. John Price is the superintendent.
They knew people who had been infected. They knew people who had died. Multiple family members who'd been hospitalized or had died.
The K through 12th grade school district is about 82% low income. Price says the administration had to work hard to set every student up with computers, internet, and headphones. But Price says that didn't solve the deeper problems.
Families and students that are living in poverty are already struggling with a lot of extra pressure and challenges.
Price says engagement has since improved, but he says that district-wide for the first quarter of the year, attendance dropped about 4 points compared to before the pandemic. WBEZ surveyed 50 school districts across the collar counties. Of the 25 that responded, districts that serve a large population of low-income students were more likely than wealthier districts to see a drop in attendance in the first quarter compared to the previous year. At this point, most of them were remote. Ann Whalen leads the policy team at Advance Illinois, an education advocacy nonprofit. She says even before the pandemic, school districts always paid close attention to attendance.
We know that when students miss between 10 and 15 days, or as people call it, chronically absent, like that's also an early indicator they need a pretty significant intervention and support.
Missed learning during the pandemic could translate into an even wider achievement gap. Elementary students on average are likely to lose 5 to 9 months of learning in math by the end of the year, according to a report from consulting group McKinsey & Company. Even worse, students of color could be behind 6 to 12 months. The pandemic has complicated how educators view attendance and what kind of policies to apply. Anthony Carter is a middle school teacher in South Suburban Stager. He's gotten a glimpse into his students' home lives during remote learning and has tried to be more accommodating to kids who can't always show up.
You know, you might have a kid who, 8th grader, 13, 14 years old, that kid may be so-called mom and dad at home right now, having to look out for younger siblings because mom and dad is out working.
About 76% of students in the Stager Elementary School District are considered low income. Stager saw a slight increase in attendance during the first quarter, and that may be thanks to a more lenient attendance policy. Fellow Stager teacher Corinne Voss says teachers are trying to respond to each student's needs.
Teachers were offering asynchronous work so that way we would be recording ourselves so that the students can watch a video, you know, of us conducting the lesson later on at night when it was a better time for them to get their optimal learning in.
For parent Yolanda Porter, she appreciated that understanding. Porter is a special education teacher with another district. During first semester, she juggled remote teaching and her fifth grade son's own virtual learning in Steger. Around Thanksgiving, she was hit hard with double pneumonia and ended up in the hospital for a week. Her doctor believes her illness was COVID-related.
I'm used to just getting up, going, doing everything I need to do myself and having to depend on others to do it because I just could not physically, like, get my body to work.
Porter considers herself fortunate that her older daughters were around to help with her fifth grader. She appreciated when school administrators reached out.
They were like, okay, if he can't log in or he has to log in late, just get him to do as much work as you possibly can. Try to feel better. What do you need? What do you need for us to do?
Porter says that flexibility has continued even as her son has returned to hybrid school. Ann Whalen with Advance Illinois says offering flexibility has been generally positive, but she says attendance does not mean students are actually learning. For example, teachers have caught students watching YouTube.
We need to make sure we're looking at multiple measures about enrollment, attendance, and engagement to better understand what's happening at that local level to ensure that our resources and our supports are responding to students in this moment.
Whalen thinks what's happening this school year could have a lasting impact on students' academic progress. She says what comes next should be dramatic interventions to reverse the damage. Susie Ahn, WBEZ News.
Environments of oppression. I join you all from the American state of mass incarceration, a state like poverty, oppression, environmental racism, police violence, and governmental repression. It is not unlike what is happening to Brother Keziah in Paris, governmental repression against dissent. Generations ago, the American Civil Rights Movement was born by the brutality, torture, and drowning death of a teenage boy, Emmett Till. Today, a global human rights movement was born by the slow motion brutality of police violence against a man in his 40s, George Floyd, who died in his 40s. George Floyd, he died by a knee on his neck. From a teenager to a man in his 40s, the repression is the same. The racial hatred is the same. The deadly result is the same. What is a human right without the right to life? We are asking that question throughout the black world, sparked by George Floyd, but it didn't begin there. It cannot end there. In an age of global pandemic, black and brown people are the first to get sick, the first to get fired, and the most to die from COVID-19. They're also the last to receive medical treatment, the last to get vaccines. Where is the human rights there? That question may be asked in Paris. That question may be asked in the United States. That question may be asked in the black world entire. We join you in this day of resistance against slavery in all its forms against the black world. And one of its greatest avatars, Frantz Fanon, who wrote and worked and lived for the wretched of the earth. For Keziah, free Keziah. From imprisoned nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
And I understand that you've got a personal relationship with Meg Markle, or had one, and she cut you off. She's entitled to cut you off if she wants to. Has she said anything about you since she cut you off? I don't think she has, but yet you continue to trash her.
OK, I'm done with this.
No, no, no.
Sorry, no. Sorry.
Do you know what? That's pathetic.
You can trash me, maybe, not my
own. No, 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 no.
See you later.
I'm being...
Sorry, can't
this
do this.
This is absolutely diabolical behaviour. I'm sorry, but Pearce spouts off on a regular basis and we all have to sit there and listen.
White-majority countries should look to the UK for a model of how to reduce racial inequality. That was one of the key findings of an independent report commissioned by the British government. So, importantly, is the report's verdict shared by minority ethnic communities? Here's Jonathan Savage.
Report after report has condemned racial inequality in the UK. But this one suggests that social class and family structure have a bigger impact on how lives turn out.
In education, in health, and particularly in the employment space, ethnic minorities are doing better than the white majority in many cases.
Tony Sewell, the chair of the Commission on Race and Ethnic Disparities, has come to a conclusion that is raising eyebrows. He says although the UK is not a post-racial society, it should be regarded as a model for similar nations. So what is he pointing to?
We've heard recently of the education system totally declaring itself institutionally racist, when if you look at the evidence, it's not the case. In fact, we have found the complete opposite. The vast majority of ethnic minorities, bar, say, for example, Black Caribbean, are actually doing better than the white majority.
The report also finds that pay gaps are getting narrower and professional diversity is increasing. The context of this commission is a movement seen around the world.
Black lives have always mattered. We have always been important. We have always meant something.
The British Prime Minister Boris Johnson asked Tony Sewell to explain social disparities in the aftermath of Black Lives Matter protests. And the findings don't deny that deep mistrust could be a barrier to success. In the 90s, an inquiry into how police investigated the murder of black teenager Stephen Lawrence found that London's police force was institutionally racist. Lawyer Matthew Ryder represented the Lawrence family.
Racism is not a simplistic problem that's applied to all people in the same way. Just because one community is achieving something and another isn't, doesn't mean racism isn't the problem. It just means racism might be more nuanced. Why is it that when white boys, for example, have less educational qualifications, they still have more opportunity of getting jobs?
The report says that overt racism is still a problem, but Tony Sewell believes things are much better than they were.
Lynton Quasey Johnson, the poet, puts it beautifully. He talks about the heroic period. In the 50s, that group came along and they had the adversity of literally the door being shut. Then he talks about my own period. That was the rebel period when we had to go against the police. The time has changed now. I call this, in another report, we call this the age of participation. This is the age now where we really go for it and take those opportunities.
But in a country where people from ethnic minorities are more likely to die from COVID-19 and where black people are many times more likely to face prison than white people, this debate is not going to go away.
Jonathan Savage reporting.
Stop using and selling drugs to one another. See, we're getting ready to be put in a real trap with this legalization of marijuana. So everybody, every black person can be unemployed and then they can sit in their corner and get high on marijuana with whatever they decide to put in it. And people won't be asking for jobs, being determined that they're going to get jobs and going to get an education. No, everybody can start getting high on marijuana because somebody said it's medicinal and it's legal.
What about,
so we better beware.
What about the people who say the legalization of marijuana is fighting against racism because you have so many black people who are unjustly incarcerated as a result of racist enforcement of these drug laws? So this would be a good thing and it would keep black people out of greater confinement.
The push to decriminalize and now legalize marijuana in New York has been a long journey, and one that advocates are hopeful will begin to reverse decades of racial inequity. Marijuana arrests have had a disproportionate impact on communities of color in New York and across the country. According to the Drug Policy Alliance, in New York State, in the first half of 2019, Black and Latinx people accounted for 75% of people arrested for low-level marijuana possession. That's despite being only 33% of the state's population. For more on New York's approach to legalization, we're joined by Melissa Moore, New York State Director for the Drug Policy Alliance. Melissa, thanks so much for being here.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
So the bill to legalize marijuana in New York State has been a long time in the making. Can you tell us how the state evolved in its stance on drugs, drug laws, and sentencing since the 1970s?
This has been a long journey. So in the 1970s in New York, we see the Rockefeller drug laws, which were some of the most draconian approaches to policymaking around drugs that had existed anywhere in the country. And the toll was immediate and devastating in communities of color and low-income communities, but really all pockets of New York mm-hmm. State. So pretty swiftly, we see this effort around especially decriminalization of low-level marijuana possession, because so much of the enforcement was targeting young people. We see this effort to decriminalize low-level possession. Unfortunately, there was a loophole within that that allowed for ongoing misdemeanor arrests if somebody's possession was considered to be in public view. And initially, that didn't have a huge impact. But then we get into the era of stop and frisk policing, broken windows policing, and those arrests skyrocket because suddenly officers are telling people to empty their pockets and are getting marijuana in public view and making an arrest from that unconstitutional stop. And so at that point, we see arrests go above 50,000 a year just in New York City alone. Mm-hmm. So there was a further effort around decriminalization that began in the early 2010s, built further and further to 2019, when unfortunately the state didn't pass full adult use for marijuana, but did pass a further effort around decriminalization and also established expungement for the first time, which was really important because up to that point, we had seen 800,000 arrests for low-level marijuana possession just in 25-year period. So as we're moving forward to this moment, you know, it's really a reckoning of so many policies from you know, the 1970s and even prior to that, that were really just rooted in stigma and had nothing to do with the plant itself and yet had devastating impacts across our state.
So what does the rollout of this bill, of this plan look like?
So the bill will cover all aspects of the cannabis plant in New York. It will have a supervisory structure for adult use cannabis, as well as bringing the medical marijuana program and the hemp CBD farming program all under the umbrella of the same organization. So it'll establish the Office of Cannabis Management, as well as a cannabis control board in New York State. But I think the key details around this bill are really how it's framed in terms of social equity and community reinvestment and restitution. You know, really acknowledging the harms that have been done under prohibition and criminalization and saying, we're not just going to turn the page and say, oh, sorry, you know, and act as if the entire history of harm in communities that was so targeted didn't happen. We have to actually acknowledge that, atone for that, and then provide restitution. And so this bill will devote a significant portion of the tax revenue to reinvestment in communities that were directly harmed by the marijuana arrest crusade and the war on drugs in New York for things that are responsive to the types of damage that has been done in communities.
Melissa, the Drug Policy Alliance and the Public Science Project at the Graduate Center CUNY released a report 2 weeks ago titled Inequitable Marijuana Criminalization, COVID-19 and Socioeconomic Disparities. Walk us through some of the key findings in that report.
You know, for quite a while now, since the beginning of the pandemic, we've been looking at the disparities and how COVID was impacting different communities. And there's been a lot of really important reporting around that. And we looked at it and realized there were so many overlaps between what we had seen for decades in terms of the racial disparities and biased enforcement around marijuana prohibition. So we actually crunched the numbers along with Public Science Project and found that what we thought to be true anecdotally is actually the case when we have the hard data in front of us, that there are extreme racial disparities in marijuana enforcement. We know that it's still the case in 2020, even during the pandemic, even after decriminalization in New York City, we still have an instance where 94% of the arrests for low-level cannabis were Black and Latinx New Yorkers. And this is despite the fact that people use at similar rates. It's simply a matter of targeted enforcement. And then we looked at the economic vulnerability indicators, the proportion of people within a community. We actually analyzed it by zip code who are experiencing food insecurity and accessing SNAP benefits, for example, or other indicators of poverty, and found that, again, there's a correlation where the communities that are the most impacted by marijuana arrests also have some of the most economic vulnerability. And then we layered the COVID data in on top of that and found that the same communities also have higher COVID positivity rates. And so it's a matter of looking at how these are structural factors that are completely intertwined. It's the same dynamics at play over and over again that are just hitting communities with wave after wave of devastation. And so as we're talking about rebuilding from the COVID crisis, as well as looking at what it is to provide restitution to the communities that were the most harmed by the marijuana arrest crusade, that's really where the conversation around how do we direct the tax revenue from cannabis legalization in New York back into these communities and make sure that there actually is, that there are resources that are going to provide for addressing the incredible harms that were done.
Yeah. And in terms of addressing that racial inequity, how does what New York is doing or trying to do differ from what other states have already done?
You know, I think this bill is the most ambitious in the country in terms of social equity. And it also has distinct streams in terms of social equity, which is really pertaining to the industry and the business portion of cannabis legalization and adult use. And then there's the community reinvestment part, which we've talked about. And that will create a community grants reinvestment fund that will have revenue available for entities that are working in communities that have been directly harmed with people who have been directly impacted to be able to access those funds. But on the social equity side, you know, this bill is really rooted in not just doing this as business as usual in New York. And I think that's really important given that we're the financial heart of the country. This bill really centers cooperatives, micro businesses, ways for people to bridge from the legacy market into the regulated space. And I think that's so crucial. And this is part of the fabric of this bill, you know, really to its core, is making sure that there will be opportunities for small businesses, for family farmers, for people all across the state who don't necessarily have access to huge amounts of capital. So New York was able, through the hard work of the bill co-sponsors, the majority leader, Crystal Peoples Stokes, and Senator Liz Krueger, they really fought for this provision and they fought for the community reinvestment, knowing that this was so much also about justice and making sure that we were going to set up the cannabis economy in New York in a way that would actually benefit, you know, small businesses and New Yorkers who have been directly impacted by prohibition. And I think that's actually like really a watershed moment for New York.
Melissa Moore is New York State Director for the Drug Policy Alliance. Melissa, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
What counts as reparations for slavery and the years of discrimination that followed? Evanston, Illinois, just outside of Chicago, recently passed a reparations initiative that centers on housing assistance. But some Black residents there say this is not reparations. Here's Araceli Gomez-Aldana from member station WBEZ.
Evanston made news last week when it passed the Local Reparations Housing Program, aimed at providing compensation to Black residents for slavery, segregation, and housing discrimination. It will provide $25,000 in home ownership, improvement grants, and mortgage assistance to qualifying Black residents. Alderman Robin Rue Simmons serves on the National African American Reparations Commission and says the housing program is only the first step of a larger reparations plan.
This initiative alone is insufficient for reparation, but this is only the first 4% of the program. But we have to start somewhere, and we started with housing in the form of $25,000 benefits.
The Evanston Reparations Subcommittee allocated $400,000 so far, a small portion of the larger $10 million reparations package, money coming from annual cannabis taxes for at least the next 10 years. But not everyone is excited about the details. Leslie Williams has lived in Evanston for 30 years.
I think it's a fundamental mistake in the way the entire program is being framed. Of misstatement of what reparations actually is.
She says reparations should include acknowledgement and apology for harm and action to stop the systemic practices causing the harm. Devarian Baldwin teaches history at Trinity College. He says reparations is now a popular term following last summer's social unrest. But he says focusing on housing could lead to reparations benefiting institutions that had a hand in creating racial disparities.
So we have to be very careful when talking about reparations and singularly locating it within kind of home repair and home ownership strategies. The issue in the spirit of reparations is about a collective transformation.
Baldwin stresses that reparations should be what he calls an act of repair.
This program in Evanston went forward with very little counsel to its own kind of institutional and local history. And so if we continue to do these top-down approaches to reparations and not include the communities and the people, we're actually exacerbating the problem. We're not solving it.
Resident Leslie Williams also thinks the passing of Evanston's reparations initiative was premature.
This is not about making white people feel better. This program, reparations, should be about actually giving economic justice to African-American people who were defrauded and robbed of institutional generational wealth for many, many decades. And, you know, that means that it's not going to be something where it can get fixed quickly.
Cities all across the country are taking measures to pass their own reparations programs, even as similar conversations are underway in Congress. For NPR News, I'm Araceli Gomez Aldana.
Did you say you saw someone steal a police horse this week?
I'll send you the video, Gus. I sent it to the firefighter. All-time classic. All-time. It might have topped when they pulled Reggie Barry out the car and Reggie Denny out the car. I mean, this was a... I'm going to send it to you. His brothers had his black power fist, and they're like, where did you get the police?
They stole a... Come on. I'm wounded.
I stole from the police.
I'm wounded. I'm totally wounded. That's...
Chicago.
Gus, I just want to report that stealing the cowboy, stealing the horse was a false report. The guy who was videotaped, he actually owned that horse. And he was falsely accused of stealing a police horse and basically got his car spray painted saying, return the horse. Yeah. So that was a false report.
I can't do it.
Think of all the disinformation online over, say, the presidential election or the COVID-19 pandemic. It's hard enough for adults to sift through all that. So how are kids supposed to navigate the cyber landscape? In Florida, some schools are teaching digital literacy under a program inspired in part by a former director of national intelligence. NPR's Greg Myrie has the story.
At Countryside High School in Clearwater, Florida, 16-year-old Sage Waite is already taking a class in cybersecurity, and she'd welcome a new class in cyber disinformation.
Well, for the longest time, I didn't actually know what disinformation was. Like, there was always the idea that things could be wrong in what you're hearing and what you're being told. But the idea of misinformation and disinformation wasn't in my day-to-day.
This past year, she says, has been an eye-opener, particularly the COVID pandemic.
The whole, oh, don't get your kids vaccinated because it could cause all sorts of things. Stuff like that, like those bigger things that's like, well, then where did that come from?
A new program on improving digital literacy is now in the works, thanks in part to Mike McConnell. His long career in national security included a stint as the director of national intelligence. At age 77, he's now focused on combating bad information aimed at young people.
We need to understand this so we can understand and appreciate what's happening to us and be able to not only understand it, but be able to navigate through it. That's what I call digital literacy.
McConnell is the executive director of Cyber Florida, which is based at the University of South Florida in Tampa. It works with kids throughout the state at universities, high schools, and even those in younger grades. McConnell's group set up the cybersecurity program now being taught at Florida schools. The new project is even more ambitious.
And we think if we can do this for Florida, we can replicate it across the nation.
Separating fact from fiction online is a major challenge for the country. We saw this in the swirling claims surrounding the presidential election and with the ongoing pandemic. Yet schools are still trying to figure out how to teach digital skills to students who increasingly live, study, and play online. At Countryside High School, computer teacher Jason Felt already has informal discussions on how disinformation is weaponized, like Russian interference in the U.S. elections.
One of the things that I've talked to my students about are nation-state actors and how nation-state actors try to attack the United States, create websites, web servers that people will visit on through social media, pass the information around.
Felt says he mostly teaches kids who already have good computer skills. The expanded program will try to make digital literacy something all students get at several grade levels. Another key partner in this project is New America. The Washington think tank is curating dozens of the most promising online tools and building a site designed to be user-friendly for teachers, parents, and school systems nationwide. Lisa Guernsey is with New America.
Sometimes a teacher may just want to help students understand what deep fakes are. In other cases, a teacher may want to spend several weeks talking about what it means to verify sources.
New America plans to have this portal up and running by summer. There's no date yet for the new classes in Florida, but teacher Jason Felt says it can't come soon enough.
The internet is a wonderful tool. It's fantastic. It's connected all of us together in a way that's never really been seen before, but it's a blessing and it's also a curse.
Teaching students the difference, he says, is a huge challenge. Greg Myrie, NPR News.
Medical apartheid. The dark history of medical experimentation on Black Americans from colonial times to the present.
So yesterday, I signed up for Governor Cuomo's new voluntary reopening tool called the Excelsior Pass, and in under a minute, it was able to verify that I have indeed been vaccinated and gave me a QR code to print out or use on my phone, good for allowing me to enter certain entertainment venues, plus wedding and bar mitzvah halls, restaurants, travel hubs, eventually, and we'll see who starts using it. You can also get one to show you had a negative COVID PCR test within 3 days, or a negative antigen and or rapid test within the last 6 hours. Personally, I'll choose to follow the CDC guidelines that even vaccinated people should not go into crowds right now. But I wanted to see what getting an Excelsior Pass was like, including what online privacy concerns it raised. So I signed up and took the download. We will get two views now on the Excelsior Pass and vaccine and negative COVID test passports in general. And we'll take your questions and experiences on the phones. First, with Brian Behlendorf, Executive Director of Linux Foundation Public Health, a tech group focused on helping governments and other institutions build open source technology to help fight the spread of COVID. Within that, he is general manager of blockchain healthcare and identity at the Linux Foundation of Public Health. Brian, thanks for coming on. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Can you first describe your group, Linux Foundation Public Health, for our listeners? Most people won't know what that is, or what open source or blockchain mean in this context.
Yeah, so the Linux Foundation is about a 20-year-old organization. We've been at the heart of the open source community, working not just on the Linux operating system, which runs everywhere in the cloud and on every Android phone, but also in all sorts of other domains. And last year, we launched Linux Foundation Public Health to serve the needs of public health authorities in the fight against the pandemic, focusing first on exposure notification. In fact, the New York State Exposure Notification app, within it, underneath it, is open source software called COVID Green that was developed by our community, by many of the companies in the community. And since December, we've been focused on this question of standards and soon implementations of open source software for implementing these vaccine passport apps.
Companies in the community, these are major tech companies. Who are some of those companies?
Yeah, the vast majority of the Fortune 1000 companies are part of the Linux Foundation as part of Linux Foundation Public Health. We have companies like Cisco and VMware and IBM, but also a very large number of startups involved, and also a huge community of volunteer software developers, medical technology experts, and increasingly the public health authorities and experts engaging directly with the technology community.
Okay, so this is big tech and big government, if people want to be cynical about it, or these are the people doing the work, if people want to be optimistic about it. So what's Governor Cuomo's vision and what's yours for how widely these kinds of passports can be used?
It's a very good question. We're not taking a position at Linux Foundation Public Health on when and where such vaccine passports should be used. Obviously, they build on the tradition of requiring vaccinations since the early part of the 20th century in the fight against yellow fever and smallpox and polio for travel between countries, for enrollments in school. Most states in the United States do require vaccinations for children to attend public school. And other professions require it as well. So it's pretty natural, I think, to ask, is there a digital way to represent that yellow card, the WHO standard yellow card, or even the CDC card that anyone who's been vaccinated in the States has received, especially since we're moving into a world where so much of our engagement is through the digital sphere. The question is how to do this in a way that has as much confidentiality and security as we can provide, but at the same time allows for reopening and the like. So it was very encouraging to see the Excelsior Pass launched and to see folks involved with that. But I think there are some very valid and substantial concerns about privacy, especially in 2021. We know a lot more about how privacy works and doesn't work on the web through third-party cookies and the like. So the technologists that we work with are really focused on how do we help guarantee privacy and confidentiality to individuals as they use passes like this in many circumstances. And things like Excelsior Pass and similar apps that are launching now all over the world and in many different states are really good steps in the right direction. But I think we'll see a second wave of such apps before the end of the year that are actually much more converged and more privacy preserving.
And it's funny, Brian, because I had sort of the opposite experience when I went online for the pass last night. The first thing that struck me signing up is that it already knew who I was. By just entering my birthday, name, and zip code, it made me prove who I was by asking for the date of my last shot, the county, and which company shot it was. And it was only when I got all three of those things right that it would give me my Excelsior Pass. And I was not particularly creeped out from a privacy standpoint, but some people might be. How did it know all that about me?
Well, there are systems that are run by many of the state health authorities called IISs, immunity information systems, that for years have centrally tracked vaccinations by the state. You know, that vaccination record is something that they have by default, and it includes your name and date of birth and home address and that kind of information. And they've maintained that for public health purposes to understand how much of the population has been vaccinated. And in many cases, those types of systems are the data sources for the issuance of these vaccination credentials, of these vaccine passports. And so I would expect that, especially if she was vaccinated, or if your listeners are vaccinated at one of the mass vaccination sites or kind of the top tier hospitals, that data would be reported. I understand from the governor's announcement, they're still working with some of the labs and some of the vaccination sites and clinics to get that reporting set up. What I think is new here, though, is that we're reporting not just vaccination, but also test results. And historically, negative test results have not been reported to state health authorities, only the positive test results. Huh. So there's a little bit of an additional data sharing going on that I think some people are rightfully not as comfortable with. Again, our hope is that in the mid to long term, the issuance of those things happens very locally. The state doesn't even need to be involved in issuing your negative test results. And that's a problem that sorts itself out. But it's important for the public to keep pressure and an eye on that.
All right. Now, our next guest, digital privacy advocate Albert Fox Kahn, says he's concerned about the terms and services, which have nothing to do with the type of app it is. And he cites the type of technology used here. And on the terms and services, I'm going to read this for you, then I'm going to read this for him. On the terms and services, when I got my Excelsior Pass last night, I had to click agree to the following page called Authorization to Disclose. And part of it says, your completion of this screening website results in the disclosure of personal information and constitutes your consent to the collection and disclosure of such information by New York State for the purposes of providing your COVID-19 test results or vaccination status, follow-up communications, contact tracing, or similar services. The application may be hosted by third parties working with New York State. Certain information you provide to or that is collected by the application may be shared with these third parties. These third parties shall limit their use of the information solely to the purposes described, with access only to the results provided and not to the underlying data. So that's a lot of words, but can you explain, in your opinion, why people should or should not be alarmed by that with respect to their privacy?
Privacy policies across the web, across these apps, they're always written by lawyers with the intent to kind of wave, and by companies who tend to put these together, to try to wave a magic wand and tell people, don't worry, it'll be okay, it'll all be right. And often it has the opposite effect, right? People read in the words may or might, kind of the implication that such sharing will happen far beyond. And of course, you know, they need to keep that language open because they don't know what regulations look like in the future, especially around public health data. But I don't think that should be something that folks accept as like the standard here. I think they should demand greater visibility and greater protection, both from the authorities that say these are the right apps to use, but also from the technology builders, that inherent in the technology should be better protections, much the way that we launched the web and started using email before we figured out how to make those secure. I've a lot of confidence that will come to this as well, down in the plumbing layer. But we also have to make that evident and very real for the users of these kinds of applications to build public trust and public confidence in them.
With me next on vaccine passports and negative COVID test passports, including the Excelsior passport introduced for New York State last week, is Albert Fox Kahn, an attorney and founder of the Surveillance Technology Oversight Project, an advocacy group that fights for online privacy rights. Some of you saw him quoted in the Gothamist article on the Excelsior Pass. Hi, Albert. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you so much for having me back.
But with respect to the passports, I mean, I could pile on to what you just said and said I have a big question about these antigen tests, the ones where you can get into a theater or something theoretically just by taking a rapid test. Those have the reliability of maybe 70%, people say. So that's not 100% confidence or the 95% confidence that you have from a vaccine, let's say, that the person is actually not able to transmit something or that they're going to even find the positive result that might actually be in the person's body. So how good is a rapid antigen test, 70% or whatever the real number is, they vary somewhere in that vicinity, for actually creating safe crowded theaters and other things like that. But that's another show. What about your concern? What about your concern with respect to the passports and privacy?
Well, this is one of the most opaque pieces of software I have seen rolled out. You know, if you look at the initial rollout, we got a few screenshots of what the user interface looked like. We got a lot of buzzwords like the fact that it supposedly uses blockchain, but we got absolutely no details about the sort of encryption, the sort of data collection, the real nuts and bolts of how this system will operate. And so you're rolling out potentially one of the most invasive apps that we will have in New York State, not because of the health data, but because it will be used to track our location data. It's something that right now we're talking about restaurants and concert venues, but some of the developers of these vaccine passports want it to be something that you have to use to go to the local supermarket. And the idea that you're going to be collecting, you know, the record of every time I buy, you know, a quart of milk from the bodega, and you're not even telling me how this app is operating, how the data is being collected, and whether there are any safeguards against access from ICE or law enforcement. And to me, that is just a dystopian nightmare in the making.
So let me be a skeptic toward your point of view and ask, why should I care about that? Or what does this actually change? Every time I use a credit card, for example, the system already knows what carton of eggs or quart of milk I bought in what bodega.
Well, for me, it wouldn't make a difference, but for my clients, for individuals who are undocumented, who have criminal justice involvement, for people who specifically don't have a credit card because of the risks of how that data is going to be tracked, who live in the cash economy, this creates another layer of tracking that suddenly becomes compulsory. And that's the thing. You know, when we're talking about these apps, the only way they would actually work as advertised is if every single person is using them, because otherwise you're not going to be able to actually create this herd immunity bubble. But if you're actually forcing everyone to use it, you're creating a lot of dangers for New Yorkers who are over-policed and are from historically marginalized communities.
Now, the Excelsior Pass website did say that it's voluntary, and my understanding is if somebody has a physical vaccination card, the thing they hand you when you get your shots, that's also usable in these same contexts. Is that your understanding, and does that get around the problem, and the voluntariness of it makes it able to be used just by people who don't have the concerns that you just rightly articulated for people in some populations, and it's this voluntary convenience thing, and you can always use your hard ticket?
Well, just because it's voluntary doesn't mean it's not coerced. And one thing we've seen is, none of the final regulations are out or the final executive orders, but what we've heard, including from, some of your colleagues at WNYC, is that there will be the ability to reopen at higher density if you're a restaurant, if you're a business, if you're using Excelsior Pass. And it's unclear to me whether that the paper card is going to be allowed as a substitute for that, because, again, we're making up the rules as we go along. And so, it can be a technically voluntary program, but if you're telling that, restaurants that the only way they can reopen with enough capacity is by using this, not just to test all the patrons, but to scan all of their employees, suddenly that looks a lot less voluntary to me.
White supremacy is the sickness.
He who pays the piper calls the tune, so the saying goes. But when it comes to a pandemic, is it right that only those who can pay get access to a life-saving vaccine? Wealthier nations have placed big advanced orders with drug companies, most of which are based in richer countries. Without more even distribution, it could take years to vaccinate enough people in the developing world. And the new head of the World Trade Organization says something needs to change. Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala, a former Nigerian finance minister, has condemned vaccine inequality and urged WTO countries to agree to waive intellectual property rights so medical knowledge can be better shared. She's been talking to the BBC's economics editor, Faisal Islam.
You can't have a situation in which 10 countries have administered 70% of vaccine doses in the world, and there are countries that have not seen one single dose. So I think that the kind of vaccine inequity we are seeing is definitely not acceptable. That's what happened with HIV/AIDS, where we had to wait 10 years for people to get access to life-saving drugs. It happened with H1N1 vaccines, where rich countries bought up the vaccines and poor countries had none. So you can understand why 100 members today are saying that they need the waiver.
But it's pretty clear in your organisations that the wealthier countries that have the vaccines and have the vaccine know-how, they don't want to share it.
They want us to do better on export prohibitions. We want them to do better on vaccine manufacturing and the transfer of know-how. So I think that everyone is beginning to see that having people vaccinated in one country and leaving others out will not necessarily solve your problem.
You've talked of a third way. Is a possible model here what has happened with the AstraZeneca vaccine developed in the United Kingdom, where you've seen a licensing with a developing country, India, and they're making hundreds of millions of doses at cost price? Is that the sort of initiative that you think could serve as a model for the rest of the world?
Increasing production precisely in the way you said. The Serum Institute has this transfer of knowledge from AstraZeneca, is able to produce up to 1 billion doses. It's the largest manufacturing capacity in the world. So if we had more of that, that kind of voluntary licensing and transfer faster, we could save many more people. Let's have the same kind of arrangement that AstraZeneca has with the Serum Institute. Novavax, J&J, and all the others should follow suit.
Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala, Director General of the World Trade Organization, talking to Faisal Islam.
There's nothing wrong with black people that ending racism can't solve.
Elijah, I wanted to ask you about two people still in prison, Mumia Abu-Jamal and the former member of the Black Panther Party, Sundiata Kolley, who's now 84 years old, has been in prison in New Jersey for nearly half a century, even though he's been eligible for parole for almost three decades. He was denied parole again in February. In fact, an appeals court said he should be freed. You've supported Kolley for decades. Last year, he contracted COVID-19 and was hospitalized. He reportedly has early-stage dementia. Do you think he'll live long enough to appear before the parole board again? And describe what could happen when his case is reviewed later this year by New Jersey's Supreme Court. And then talk about Mumia Abu-Jamal. And he also contracted COVID-19 in a Pennsylvania prison.
Yes, thank you. Sundiata has been denied parole six times by the New Jersey Parole Board. Each time they claim that he's a risk to public safety. He's 84 years old, and since 1979, he's been held in federal facilities. And his last job in the federal facility where he's held now, before the pandemic, was to teach a course called Avoiding Criminal Thinking, which he was tapped to teach by the Bureau of Prisons to incarcerated men so that they could avoid recidivism when they return to society. So clearly he presents no risk, and at 84 years old with dementia, it's just unfounded that they should continue to deny him. His current hit before the parole board, which means how old he would have to be before he could return, is 93. And he is waiting now to see how much more time the parole board is going to tack on to that before he should be eligible to return to the parole board. So basically, they are hoping and trying to make sure that he dies in prison. It's important to understand that in New Jersey, there is a presumption of a right to parole. So when someone serves their minimum sentence, then they should be eligible for parole unless their disciplinary record indicates otherwise. Sundiata has had a completely discipline-free record for the past 27 years, so he's been more than eligible for release. This fall, the New Jersey Supreme Court will hear the appeal of his denial of his fourth appearance before the parole board, and we are hopeful that at least we'll be successful in the courts in New Jersey.
And we just have 20 seconds, Sophia, but the latest on Mumia Abu-Jamal, who had COVID.
Yes, Mumia also contracted COVID-19 inside the prisons, and it's a clear indication, as we talked about earlier, about the lack of social distancing and the lack of adequate health care for incarcerated people. And I hope and pray that Mumia survives.
Sophia Elijah, I want to thank you so much for being with us, Executive Director of the Alliance of Families for Justice. That does it for our show. A very happy birthday to Mike Burke, and a fond farewell to Libby Rainey, our producer, who we have traveled all over from the firefighting prison camps in Northern California to the border, to those long train rides between Washington, D.C. at the last minute in New York, and wherever a UN climate summit is in the world. Your compassion, your humor, and your intelligence will be missed. And fond farewell and best of luck in law school. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks so much for joining us.
Also, allow me to apologize to other families formed through transracial adoption, because I am deeply sorry that we suggested that interracial families are in any way funny or deserving of ridicule.
What has a year of increased violence against Asian Americans meant for Asian adoptees? They report experiencing racism, just like other people of color, and yet many feel they are left out of conversations about what's happening. NPR's Ashley Westerman explored why.
Bethany Long Newman says she saw herself in the Korean women killed on March 16th when a gunman went on a rampage at three spas outside of Atlanta.
When I first heard about it, I was immediately scared. You kind of put yourself in their shoes a bit and you think this could happen to me or my daughter.
But Newman, who lives in Chicago, didn't really have anyone who looks like her to talk with about it. You see, she's adopted, born in South Korea, but raised by a white family in a predominantly white rural community in Kentucky. Even now, her husband is white, and most of her Asian friends are adopted too.
I feel heartbroken and scared, and I don't know how to express it because I don't know that most people around me, if they necessarily think of me as Asian.
Newman says her mom did reach out, but
my mom asked if I felt safe, and she asked if there had been any violence against Asians in Chicago. And I said, not that I know of, and that's kind of where we left it.
Hing Potter has mulled over similar thoughts when it comes to his white parents. He's adopted from Cambodia and says it's even hard to talk with other Asian Americans about it.
Am I Asian enough to have this conversation with other Asian people, other Asian Americans in the community?
It's estimated there are more than 200,000 Asian adoptees in the U.S., and many, like Newman and Potter, report having trouble knowing how to feel and talk about the uptick in anti-Asian violence, even to parents who have been generally supportive in the past. Kimberly McKee, an Asian American Studies professor at Grand Valley State University, says that disconnect may stem from how they were raised.
If your parents applied a colorblind philosophy and said that they only see you as you, they don't see you as Asian, you may just lack the language to have certain kinds of conversations.
She says Asian adoptees experience racism just like other people of color, and many are grappling with anti-Asian violence like the rest of the Asian American community. It's just hard to articulate when you've never felt like you truly belong in either world.
So for adoptees of color, they're obviously not white. And then if your family is living in an all-white suburb, you may just not interact with a lot of people of color in general.
These frustrations have spilled over in the last year. I know. Because I'm an Asian adoptee too, and I've seen more people openly talk about this in online groups dedicated to adoptees. And while having such outlets are helpful, family members, even if they're not Asian, can do more. Nicole Chung is also an adoptee and author of the memoir All You Can Ever Know. She has some tips.
I think just listening, being open and available, being present and just here for whatever they have to share, it's not nothing, you know, I think that's important.
She also suggests reaffirming and validating someone's racial reality and acknowledging the long history of anti-Asian discrimination in the U.S. Ultimately, Chung says there's no time like the present to be having these conversations.
And better late than never.
Ashley Westerman, NPR News.
One scenario that was raised, it was a non-white person. She was saying she had just got your code book. She was reading through it. And she was saying that you have... She said, Chinese person. She said she's in New York, and she says she when she gets certain jobs, frequently it'll be a so-called Chinese person will be the individual that is her supervisor. And she was saying that she treats them as suspects because they'll function in a manner that's incorrect, and they'll end up mistreating her, and they'll be a so-called Chinese person. So she says just because of the way that they're functioning, she'll suspect that they could be white, they could be a racist white
supremacist. And that she, no, they can't be white if they are non-white. Just like Haitians can't be white just because they're mistreating somebody. This is mistreatment, that's all. And ain't nothing new about black people and non-white people mistreating each other. Chinese go at each other. I mean, you know, that's why a lot of them, I mean, you know, the ones in Hong Kong don't like the ones on the mainland. The ones in Taiwan don't like the ones in Hong Kong and all that nonsense. North Vietnamese fighting South Vietnamese. I mean, wholesale slaughter. I mean, nobody could say that that was hey, they're all Vietnamese and they love each other. I mean, that was obvious. That wasn't true. So if some black person get caught in the crossfire and whatnot, I mean, you know, black people say, well, they don't like me, you know, because I'm black. Well, what if you were Vietnamese? I mean, you know, you'd still be catching the same bullet. From another Vietnamese. I mean, see what I mean? You know, so, you know, no. We need to look at things the way they actually are. It's all messed up. And why is it that way? Because the white supremacists are white supremacists. They know how to make a mess of everything.
The mass shooting in Atlanta last month and the surge of anti-Asian attacks across the country over the last year have intensified the rallying cry to end violence against Asian Americans. That crescendo comes less than a year after the wave of protests following the death of George Floyd in Minneapolis. For years, Black Lives Matter has demanded an end to police brutality and racially motivated attacks against black people. And now with heightened calls for solidarity between the black and Asian American communities, we wanted to look at the relationship between them and how their civil rights movements have interacted. Joining us now is anti-racist author and consultant Kim Tran. Her research focuses on Asian American solidarity with the Black Lives Matter movement. Welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
So I'm just wondering, Kim, as you've been listening to the calls for solidarity between Asian Americans and Black Americans right now, how much of this moment feels reminiscent to you of other times in the past, like, say, after the LA riots in 1992?
So the first thing I want people to know is that solidarity is there. It's been there. You know, we can trace the historical roots of Asian Black solidarity back to 1955 with the Ban Dung Conference, where representatives of people from the Asian continent and folks on the African continent came together to talk about what decolonization was going to look like for both of us. Fast forward to things like the relationship between Thich Nhat Hanh and Dr. King, and then all the way to, you know, the fight against the Klan in New Orleans in the 80s with Vietnamese fishermen. So within the American imaginary, we are interested in racial antagonism between Black and Asian folks. However, what we see time and time again is that we also work in concert against racial injustice. And the most recent iteration of what that looks like is the formation of Asians for Black Lives in 2014, 2015, after the call for solidarity from Black Lives Matter.
Well, as you say, there has been tension between these two communities, Black Americans and Asian Americans. And even though the common goal of these two movements is to address colonization and to dismantle white supremacy, white supremacy has harmed Black Americans in a very different way than it has harmed Asian Americans. Like, Asians in this country have never felt what it's like to be enslaved in this country, to be mass incarcerated, right?
Yeah, that's true. And this is the moment where I ask us to walk and chew gum at the same time. Right. If I'm being really honest, I think one of the things that would be the most productive move for American racial discourse is to be able to hold racial difference and racial injustice in their own specific and unique lived experiences. They're not equivalent, and we should not rank them. What we have to do is have a conversation about the ways in which the Asian American experience is unique and different from the Black American experience, and vice versa.
But given that experiences within the Asian American community are different from experiences within the Black American community, can you talk about how those differences have played out in terms of tension between the two movements?
So one of the tensions is we're actually talking across each other, even within our own racial group. There are Asian Americans who are abolitionists, who don't want to increase funding for police, who don't believe in locking folks up. And then there are other Asian Americans who say, let's persecute and prosecute these people who are perpetuating the hate crimes. That's a tough conversation. And it's a really good example of the deeper seated kind of chasms that exist within the greater racial injustice discourse. So BLM was a very crystallizing moment in that it forced us to reckon with the specificity of anti-Blackness. And now, as we're seeing Asian Americans come into this conversation a bit more on a wider scale, on a grander scale, what we're seeing is the capacity of Asian Americans to say, okay, Black Lives Matter is this thing. The fight against anti-Asian violence is this thing. We are joint in some ways. We are unique in others, but we're going to show up together. Mm-hmm. And that is extremely exciting.
Well, where can Asian Americans start to better show up? Because at some level, it seems that there has to be some acknowledgement that they do enjoy greater privilege in this society than Black Americans do, and therefore might be able to exert leverage if they were to fuse their movement with Black Americans.
Let's start by being honest. As a Southeast Asian woman who is light-skinned, when I walk down the street, I am not worried that a police officer is going to pull me over and kill me just for existing on the sidewalk. On the other side, as a queer Vietnamese woman, I am extremely afraid in this moment that walking down the street, I might encounter someone who wants to do something really violent toward me because they don't think I belong in this country and because they think I brought the pandemic that we're currently experiencing.
Yeah.
This is a kind of nuance that activists are really good at. It, however, is not a skill that American racial discourse has developed on a wider scale. And as Asian Americans, I'm really asking that we push ourselves to hold that kind of complexity. It's hard. There are very few models for it, but it's what we need to do in order to get to where we have to go.
Kim Tran is an anti-racist consultant and author. Thank you so much for joining our show today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Listen. Just touching on some real issues right here tonight. That's all.
That's all.
I want y'all to observe the excellence here. BX providing the sonics, my man, Minnesota. I'm letting the beat ride out because it's a part that I like when it come up, you know what I'm saying? I take this time to say what's up to my family. You hear that? You know what I'm saying?
For sure.
Just observe the excellence of that. That's many.
Then. Hey, back. Fall back.
With the guitars. It's hip-hop music. It's good enough to speak for itself. And you got to do right by it. Minnesota.
Ain't no black people in Minnesota.
So far, the murder trial of Derek Chauvin has seen days of emotional testimony from bystanders who watched the former Minneapolis police officer press his knee into George Floyd's neck. The trial took a turn today. Lawyers questioned witnesses about Floyd's drug use and the efforts to resuscitate him. And at the end of the day, we heard from Chauvin's former supervisor. NPR's Adrian Florido is covering the trial in Minneapolis and joins us now. Hey, Adrian.
Hi, Elsa.
So I understand the first witness to testify today was George Floyd's girlfriend. Why did prosecutors call her to the stand?
Well, they seem to be trying to accomplish two things. They wanted to humanize Floyd, but as we learned today, his girlfriend was also someone that George Floyd often used drugs with. And because the defense is going to be focusing a lot on Floyd's drug use, the prosecution seemed to be trying to get ahead of that by acknowledging that Floyd did use drugs and just diving into it.
Okay, so tell us about her testimony today.
Well, her name is Courtney Ross. She said she met Floyd in 2017 in the lobby of the Salvation Army, where Floyd worked as a security guard. She was having a bad day, she said, and Floyd walked up to her.
Floyd has this great, deep, southern voice, raspy. He's like, sis, you okay, sis? And I wasn't okay. I said, no, I'm just waiting for my son's father. He said, well, can I pray with you?
She said their relationship developed quickly after that. They liked taking walks. Because Floyd was such a large man, he ate a lot, so they liked eating out. But she also said they took drugs together, opioids. And she said that started because they both had chronic pain.
We both had prescriptions, but after prescriptions that were filled and we got addicted and tried really hard to break that addiction many times.
She also testified that about 3 months before he died, Floyd had had an overdose and spent a few days in the hospital.
I'm curious, did Chauvin's defense lawyer press her on this drug use?
He did, and he was especially interested in something Ross told investigators who were looking into this case after Floyd's death, which is that just a week before Floyd died, she and he had acquired some pills that were highly stimulant and made them jittery.
Do you recall telling the FBI that when you had that, you felt like you were going to die?
I don't remember saying that, but I did see it in the transcript.
So also, while prosecutors want the jury to sympathize with Floyd's struggles with drugs, the defense seems to be trying to draw a line from his drug use to his panic and the struggle that he put up when officers tried to arrest him, to ultimately argue that it was the drugs that an autopsy found in his system and not Chauvin's knee that killed George Floyd.
Well, there was also testimony today from the paramedics who tried to resuscitate Floyd that night. What did they say?
Well, there was a lot of technical testimony about what they did try to do to revive him, but the most important moment came when paramedic Derek Smith was asked what he felt when he checked Floyd's pulse while Chauvin was still on top of him.
In a living person, there should be a pulse there. I did not feel one. I suspected this patient to be dead.
Obviously powerful testimony for the prosecution, which is arguing that Chauvin stayed on top of Floyd for much longer than he should have.
Right. Well, as we mentioned, at the end of the day, the sergeant who was Derek Chauvin's supervisor took the stand, and he was asked precisely about that, right?
Yes, Sergeant David Ploeger. Here's what Prosecutor Steve Schlisher asked him.
Based on your review of the body-worn camera footage, do you have an opinion as to when the restraint of Mr. Floyd should have ended in this encounter?
Yes.
What is it?
When Mr. Floyd was no longer offering up any resistance to the officers, they could have ended their restraint.
Of course, on cross-examination, defense attorney Nelson got him to say that policing is hard, dangerous. We expect a lot more on this use of force question in the weeks ahead.
Right. That is NPR's Adrian Florido in Minneapolis. Thank you.
Thanks, Elsa.
Virginia departs the death game. The state of Virginia, long the center of the American system of using the death penalty, has now, just days ago, abolished it. Virginia, the state from which most U.S. presidents have emerged, has been using the death penalty for over 400 years. But on Wednesday, March 24th, 2021, Governor Ralph S. Northam signed a bill abolishing Virginia's capital punishment program. This marked the first state of the former Confederacy in the South to formally abolish its death penalty. It marked the 23rd of the United States to abolish the practice. In Virginia, the death penalty dispatched some 1,300 souls over its long exercise. According to the New York Times, the 20th century of Virginia's death row saw 377 prisoners executed, of which 79% were black. That salient fact may have marked the legal formal end of Virginia's exercise of the death penalty. The governor told reporters, "Ending the death penalty comes down to one fundamental question. Is it fair?" New York Times, March 25th, 2021. The abolition itself seems to answer the question. But it's also possible that given the economic aftermath of the COVID-19 pandemic, states like Virginia faced serious fiscal challenges. For as businesses closed, tax revenues diminished substantially. Virginia shows us that even the death penalty can die. From imprisoned nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Every nigga is a star. Every nigga is a star. Who will deny that you and I and every nigga is a star?
judgmental and discriminatory, but how should you handle a situation that you feel is fueled by racism? The question is being raised tonight following the firing of a pizza delivery man after a Massapequa woman says he sent her a racist text message. News 12's Andrew Anger takes a look. It's the latest in a story you saw first on 12.
Over the weekend, Lachey Jerry got a text she wasn't expecting.
I was upset. I mean, I started crying. I felt very, very disrespected. I felt like it was discrimination.
The text message, she says, was from a delivery driver from I Love Pizza in Wantagh. The message, she says, came after she decided not to tip the driver when her food was nearly 2 hours late. She had been spending the day with her family in Wantagh Park. She showed us the text, which said, "Black lives matter, but yours doesn't. You N-word expletive, get out of Wantagh."
Why the heck do you want to call the police? Because this is about to be an issue.
Lachey and her mother then confronted the owner of the store while on social media, complaining about the message. The owner tells News 12 he apologized, offered a refund, and fired the driver on the spot. Police later arrived and took a report.
This is a hate crime, and she does want to look into further investigation.
But do text messages or other forms of harassment happen often? Civil rights activists say you might be surprised.
These things are happening all the time. It's just that they don't necessarily have the same level of attention.
Elaine Gross from Erase Racism says acts of racism happen on a daily basis, whether it is in housing discrimination, voting, or even hate crimes. She says in this case, the victim did the right thing and complained to the owner, and the owner acted swiftly and appropriately. She says filing a police report and possibly contacting civil rights organizations is also a good idea.
Please speak up. Please don't let that kind of behavior go unnoticed and unrecognized. It's not something to be ignored or swept under the rug.
Andrew Enger, News 12, Long Island.
Now, News 12 has reached out to the pizza delivery driver for comment, but we did not get a response. Meantime, the Nassau police say it's conferring with the district attorney's office if any further action is warranted.
The man, race, class, genre, and the dilemmas of black manhood.
He's strong. He's a lot stronger than I was at that age.
Shortly after Devin Freeland graduated high school, he was brutally attacked for simply existing and now has one last dental surgery to endure.
It's definitely been hard seeing your son every day, you know, with a missing teeth and, you know, only 19 years old, and nobody should go through that.
Last summer, the Department of Justice says Lee Mowat targeted a group of black teenagers at Sterling State Park in Monroe. Using racial slurs, Mowat said the teens didn't belong there and attacked Devin, knocking out several teeth and fracturing his jaw. Devin's dad says he has only one question for the 43-year-old Newport man.
They're kids. You know, you're a grown man. You didn't have to, you know, swing a lock and hit my son in the face and could have killed him. My question to him would be, why?
Officials charged Mowat with a federal hate crime, saying the young victim in this case suffered tremendously from this vicious, racially motivated assault, and that hate-fueled incidents like this have no place in a civilized society.
In this day and age, you would think that people would be a little bit more kind and a little bit more loving towards one another, and, you know, we just see that that's not the case.
On Tuesday, Mowat pleaded guilty to willfully injuring the teen because of his race.
I'm glad that, you know, he did take the initiative to plead guilty. The justice part comes when we see exactly how much time he's going to do.
And Mowat's sentencing is in June. He's facing up to 10 years in prison and a $250,000 fine. I'm Priya Mann, local for News Today.
That's right. We move it to Mississippi, and you know how that's spelled. M-I, crooked letter I, crooked letter I, hook back, I.
Assault on his life, and I really believe that they were trying to kill him.
Pastor Terry Smith of Ripley, Mississippi, is the uncle of Paris Smith, who was shot in the head March 11th outside this house on County Road 825. The shooting followed an argument Smith reportedly had with the neighbor he accused of stealing some of his property.
Actually, he went to the man's house and confronted him and said, "My personal items have been stolen, and I want them back."
Tippett County Sheriff Carl Galliard confirms the argument involved alleged stolen property and escalated into violence, and that Smith was shot in the head. But the sheriff declined to go into details, saying, quote, "This is an ongoing investigation involving the Tippett County Sheriff's Office, the Mississippi Bureau of Investigation, and the Tippett County District Attorney." The man who admitted to shooting Smith tells News Channel 3 he did so after Smith came onto his property armed and threatened him and his son. The man who wouldn't go on camera says after the confrontation moved back to Smith's father's house, Smith assaulted his wife, and Smith and his father fired shots at the man's family, bullets hitting a tire and the side of this pickup truck. Pastor Smith says his nephew was only defending himself.
A young lady attacked him. He put up his hands to, like, fend her off, and some shots were fired. And my nephew was struck in the head.
But Smith's sister says the shooting was racially motivated, and the woman had been yelling racial slurs.
"I don't like using the N-word, but saying, open up the door, where's your son? All of these things lead us to believe that, yes, this is a hate crime and highly racially motivated."
When asked if his office considers this a racially motivated crime, the sheriff said, "Everything is on the table. If it leads to that, we'll take appropriate action." Smith's relatives are also concerned the sheriff is asking for more detailed witness statements, even though Smith's father filed a statement the night of the shooting. Jessica Gertler, WREG News Channel 3.
It's a mess of irony for all the world to see. It's the nation's capital, it's Washington, D.C. It's the nation's capital, it's the nation's capital, it's the nation's capital, Washington, D.C.
It is with a very, very heavy heart that I announce one of our officers has succumbed to his injuries.
That's Acting U.S. Capitol Police Chief Yogananda Pittman announcing the death of Officer William Evans, an 18-year veteran of the force. Another officer is still in the hospital today, but is stable and has non-life-threatening injuries after yesterday's attack on him and his partner as they stood at a barrier on Capitol grounds. The suspect in that attack also died. Several news organizations report he was a 25-year-old man from Indiana. NPR has not confirmed those reports. Joined now by NPR congressional reporter Claudia Grisales. Claudia, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
This has been trying and sad times for the Capitol Police, and that was acknowledged by the chief, wasn't it?
Yes. Capitol Police have lost two officers after the January 6th insurrection, and now you have the loss of a new officer that you mentioned there in this new tragedy. You could hear it in Pittman's voice as she talked to a reporter. Let's take a listen.
"I just ask that the public continue to keep U.S. Capitol Police and their families in your prayers. This has been an extremely difficult time for U.S. Capitol Police."
The Capitol has seen security installed after the insurrection scaled back in recent weeks. So this will shape current talks on this and how lawmakers can better support these officers.
Claudia, as authorities have been able to piece things together, what exactly happened yesterday?
Pittman said that shortly after 1 p.m. local time, this suspect entered the north barricade of the Capitol. Normally, this is a busy entrance to the Senate, but Congress was in recess, so it was supposed to be a quiet day. Pittman said this suspect rammed his car into two of their officers, struck a barricade, and then exited his vehicle, lunging at officers with a knife, at which time they opened fire. The suspect was pronounced dead, while one of those officers, as we mentioned at the top there, William Evans, who was known as Billy, died. As you mentioned, he was an 18-year veteran, and we know he was a father to two children, Logan and Abigail. This is the other officer remains in the hospital, but he is in stable condition with non-life-threatening injuries.
And what response have we had so far from President Biden and congressional leaders?
Biden said he will continue to be briefed on this incident and that he and the First Lady, Jill Biden, shared their condolences and gratitude for the Capitol Police. Congressional members struck a similar note. Both Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer and House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said they both spoke with the Evans family and shared their condolences. Ohio Democratic Congressman Tim Ryan, his subcommittee oversees the Capitol Police, told reporters that this incident ripped off the scab, if you will, that was left after the January 6th insurrection. It hits hard for this family of lawmakers, police, and others that have grown closer since the riot.
And what's ahead after this incident, Claudia?
So Acting D.C. Police Chief Robert Conti said his department's Homicide and Internal Affairs divisions will investigate the death of the officer and the suspect. Here's what he said.
Clearly, this was someone who was actively trying to just get at whoever or whatever. We just don't know right now. So we have a responsibility to investigate that, to get to the bottom of this.
He also told reporters there was no indication this suspect was known to area law enforcement or that this is terrorism related, but we're expecting this to add to the layers of investigations already ongoing in the aftermath of the insurrection.
NPR congressional reporter Claudia Grisales, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Now look at this. I'm saying that once you start talking about genetic survival, we're getting into the white supremacy mindset. You've got to understand what is in the white supremacy mindset. You cannot impose. See, we want to impose. Everybody wants to get along. That's not where they're coming from. See, they're coming from white genetic survival by any means necessary. Now, how do I assure my genetic survival? What exactly do I have to do?
Scientists have long warned that sperm counts are declining, but a new book, Countdown, suggests that the rate of decline is far more alarming than had previously been feared. So, if, as the book claims, sperm counts in Western men fell by half from 1973 to 2011, where could this trajectory take us? A question Tim Franks put to the book's co-author, Shanna Swan.
That line would, just mathematically, if extended, hit zero at 2045.
So those are the numbers. What have you done to try and work out what is causing this?
We've looked at lots and lots of causes. And if we divided them into two classes, I would say there's lifestyle. And those are things that we have quite a bit of control over, such as our smoking, obesity, heavy drinking. The harder question, and I think the more important question, is the role of chemicals in our environment. And I spent much of the past 20 years looking at measured levels of chemicals in the bodies of pregnant women and relating them to how their male offspring developed. But those chemicals are chemicals that are able to alter the body's hormones. So those critical drivers of our reproductive health can be thrown off by chemicals in our everyday products.
When you're saying chemicals, you're talking about a particular class of plastics, are you?
So there are the phthalates, which I've spent most time studying. Those are chemicals that make plastic soft and flexible. They're not only in plastic, by the way. They're also in our personal care products. They're in fragrances. They're actually in pesticides. But there are other things in plastics. You probably have heard of bisphenol A. The bisphenols make plastic hard. They are hormonally active as well. And then there's other things in our home, like our cushions and our sofas are treated with flame retardants that can affect our hormones, and our frying pans are coated with Teflon that can affect our hormones.
And are you absolutely confident that you're not just sort of seeing a correlation here, you're seeing a causal link?
As far as the phthalates go, yes. We looked at the actual mechanistic action of phthalates in the test tube, and they do have the ability to lower testosterone. That's one thing. Then there are animal studies, and many, many of these, that show that phthalates, when the mother is exposed to these in early pregnancy, then the male offspring is likely to develop this cluster of changes, I would say, which have been termed the phthalate syndrome.
If these products are doing what you're saying to the sperm count, to the point where, you know, human reproduction could be threatened, do you think they need to be banned?
I think they need to be regulated. Currently, in the US at least, chemicals can be put into products without being tested. In the EU, there is the regulation called REACH, which requires manufacturers to test chemicals before they're put into products. However, that testing, it's uncertain how much it protects us, because if you test one chemical at a time, you're not testing the exposure to which we're exposed, which is many, many chemicals, perhaps up to 100. And where they're not testing very low doses, which are risky, and they're not worrying about what gets into the environment. So the regulations have to be tightened, and they have to be applied before chemicals are put into commerce.
Shana Swan.
Context of white supremacy. What a week. Gusty Renegade, in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, April 3, 2021, so I have been told. This is our weekly compensatory call-in. Dial in if you have thoughts, questions, suggestions. The number is 720-716-7300, the code 564-943, pound, press star 61 if you would like to participate. White genetic annihilation. Dr. Welsing would have said you all should read that book in the book club immediately. Not that they don't have other books like that. The Birth Dearth. That would be one. Ben Wattenberg, that's one. The ISIS papers. But the countdown should be coming to the Cows Book Club sometime soon. But wowee, Dr. Francis Cress Welsing, I think Easter Sunday is tomorrow. I think that whole so-called holiday is in some way connected to pagan fertility rituals, unless I have been misinformed. The number again is 720-716-7300, the code 564-943, pound, press star 61 if you would like to participate. The eggs and all that, right? Fertility, eggs, bunny rabbits, fertility. Anywho, what a week. I will start the very last report that we heard. That is easily one of the longest news segments, like the total length of that audio segment that we've had on the compensatory call-in over the years. And not that, you know, what I have to say, what other victims who call in have to say isn't important. It certainly is. But I mean, wow, it was many, many things that happened this week that was, you know, a scant representation of the things that happened in the known universe or even in the area called the U.S. But this was a week where it was very difficult to even make sense and process because so many things were happening so quickly in all different parts of the world. But that last segment, fertility rates, in a week where there were so many things to talk about, they made time to talk about fertility rates. It immediately... We had Judith Finlayson on the program just a few days back, and I read one section from her book that I thought was very constructive. But one section that I did read from page 90, parabens and low sperm counts. For decades, men's sperm counts have been falling. In parts of the developed world, they have declined by about 60% over the past 40 years. At this point, there are few human studies, but like those taking place in laboratories, the ones that exist are producing alarming results. Parabens, chemicals widely used in products such as toilet soaps, shampoo, and makeup, have been associated with DNA damage to male sperm. A Polish study published in 2017 found that high concentrations of parabens in male urine samples were linked with changes to sperm robustness that contributed to male infertility. In 2017, New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof extrapolated from current data on lower sperm counts to propose that if present trends continue, by 2060, a majority of the men living in Europe and North America might be infertile. I asked Judith Reisman, or excuse us, Judith Finlayson, I asked her about that specifically when she was with us just a week or two ago. And this seems, those specific regions, that seems like we're talking about white men specifically. By 2060, the majority. That is extra. Dr. Frances Cress Welsing, white genetic annihilation. I asked her, like, is this something that's being talked about, like, regularly? And I think, New York Times, that would be one. And then you just heard that was the BBC on this week with everything that happened this week. Easter Sunday, bunny rabbits, they made time to discuss that book, Countdown, Cal's Book Club. Let me stick with Judith Finlayson for one second. We've been on the context of white supremacy for 12 years. We have a whites-only guest policy now. I'm just doing a comparison contrast. You can extrapolate from it what you please. We had Ms. Bausch. She was a guest on the program, white woman, suspected racist, Olympic silver medalist, vegan. She was on the program earlier this year, talked about the importance of getting away from dairy for proper health, right in line with Judith Finlayson. And she is homies with Dr. Milton Mills, who is a black male, victim of white supremacy. He does a lot of great work talking about racism and health. He's in the documentary, What the Health? I said, hey, you've been on our program. You've heard, you know, what we talk about and what have you. You can be a liaison. Tell him, you know, hey, you should give a word or two, chat it up with Gus, and tell his listeners about the importance of eating well. And she said, oh, I'd be happy to do it. I'll send him a message and let him know that I think it'd be great for him to come and talk to you guys. So I typed up my interview request, forwarded to Ms. Bausch. She sent me, I guess she carbon copied me in the response to him, which, you know, was purportedly excited and very much recommending that he come and speak to us. This is what I heard from Dr. Milton Mills. Not even crickets. Not a word, which might be his code. Minimize contact. Many people, I've said this for years, everybody hates, or I won't say everybody, but I mean, whew, legions, non-white people, white people, hate Gus T. Renegade and or the cows. Might have been minimizing contact. He's not even worthy of a reply. Judith Finlayson, who I did even criticize for not being direct and talking about racism, she wrote me back. This is what she said. I thought a lot about your program. You are doing a great service by introducing the principles of healthy eating to your audience. I was especially interested to learn that one listener, the gentleman who believed obesity was an individual's own fault, changed his mind after listening to the show. I will pause. That was Mo in Dallas. I think just for accuracy, I don't think he changed his mind, but I think he did say he would accept the information and kind of think on it a bit more. But I don't think he said that he was changing his mind about individuals being culpable for being or suffering from obesity. He can set the record straight if that's true. In any case, I'm delighted to send you a copy of The Vegetarian Slow Cooker. I made a compensatory investment request for that book. Be aware that since it travels from Canada and the U.S., its arrival will be very tardy. Man, since the border closed, it takes forever for mail. We were talking about doing a retreat in Toronto last year. Do you know the border is still closed more than a year later? Anyway, it takes a long time for books to travel, and it is expensive. Like, man, I'm certain the cost of mailing that book alone is worth like 3-4 times what the book is worth. Like, whew, great compensatory investment request. Let's see. If it doesn't arrive within 2 weeks, let me know. I include that not for any kudos, because I say the same thing that I've said for years in terms of all of that. I learned from one of the best, the late, the grandsister, Dr. Maya Angelou. She said, I take all of the compliments, I take all the criticisms, and I throw them all in the trash. That is one of the great motivating reasons why I've said for years, if you like the cows, so what? If you don't like the cows and or despise Gus T. Renegade, so what? The goal, our cosmic assignment remains, replace white supremacy with justice. But the comparison contrast, there are many reasons why it's white guests only. I totally accept and acknowledge many, many victims of white supremacy, even ones who talk about racism, white supremacy, like Dr. Milton Mills, would not be caught dead standing within a 500-mile radius of Gus T. Renegade, much less speaking to me. No problem. White guests only. That's the only reason that I'm sharing. Comparison contrast. In my experience, I found it to be much easier to talk to individuals that I suspect of being racist, even individuals sometimes that I have accused of being suspected racists. Much easier. I learn much more. That is the foundation of what the cows is about. Anyway, white guests only. I get to say all that to do my spiel right, to say, Dr. Gerald Horn, non-white male, black male, will be on the program this Monday. And I know folks out there have been saying, you can say all that you want to. Dr. Horn had better be on this program this Monday. I was ready last Wednesday. We had cows listeners from across the planet. Stayed awake, time difference and everything. Like, I set my alarm and got up for you to be fooling around and say that you messed up the date and time with Dr. Gerald Horn, preeminent scholar who has written like dozens of books on white supremacy, racism, for you to be fooling around and mess up the date and time. Whew. Dr. Horn had better be here Monday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Had us all excited to talk about Muhammad Ali and Jack Johnson and Marvelous Marvin Hagler and Floyd Mayweather and Don King and Joe Lewis and long list. And said, just be patient. The book is amazing. The Bitter Sweet Science, all about white supremacy. White supremacy dominating the field of boxing, which is a totally barbaric sport. That's another big point in the book. Totally barbaric. Should be done away with, like, immediately. But he'll be here Monday. Sorry for everybody who was excited for Wednesday. As these news clips indicate, it has been a very treacherous 2021, and I'm so appreciative. Dr. Horn, a total gentleman and a scholar. I didn't even mess around. I was just like, man, I got confused about the date. I thought I was confirming. It's like, oh, Negros. he didn't even name call. He just rescheduled and rock and roll. Gentleman and a scholar, Dr. Gerald Horn, with us on Monday. It's still white guests only. Let's see. Scroll down my list here. I had so many things that I took note of. I had to move back to make sure I got the note with Dr. Judith Finlayson. Let's see. The shooting in Washington, D.C. I'll just have to do it by memory until I can scroll backwards. Yes, the shooting in Washington, D.C. Immediately, I thought of Miriam I. Carey. October of 2013, with her one-year-old daughter in the back seat. When I read this report, the first thing I thought was, wow, they allege that Noah Green, this black male, that he rammed into a barricade and then exited his vehicle and lunged at the officers with a knife. Like, wow, Miriam Carey wasn't even given that much leeway. Like, she didn't even get an opportunity to exit her vehicle. Like, I have a child in the vehicle. Like, what? None of that. Like, immediate execution. But that was the first thing I thought of. Then, as I thought of Miriam I. Carey, I said, whoa, like, I need a lot of detail. Like, if this happened at the Capitol, and specifically, this happened at the Capitol just days, literally, after all of that white terrorism, there should be lots of video footage to confirm everything that you said. He lunged at the officer. Like, and I mean, it's not like we have a sensitivity about seeing black males get choked out, shot to death, stabbed, whatever it is. Like, that's, you know, nightly entertainment. New hashtag and popcorn time, right? No, I need a whole lot of detail, because that's the same thing that they said about Miriam I. Carey, that, oh my God, she was believing in conspiracy theories and she thought President Obama was after her. And, oh, she, what did they say? She ran over a barricade and bumped an official and all the rest of it. She may have had explosives. Remember that? They just had lie after lie after lie after lie on a black mother, Miriam I. Carey, October of 2013. So I need a whole, and it's particularly, they had in the New York Times, the lead of the article, I put it as the photo for the Facebook event for this broadcast, that Mr. Noah Green, the alleged driver suspect in all this, that he was a follower of Louis Farrakhan. You can insert the, like, dun dun dun. I even thought, like, wow, is that still, like, that's a, it's 2021. Like, I would think maybe 1995 you could do this one, maybe 2005. Like, oh yes, the anti-Semite Louis Farrakhan and all the rest. But I mean, it's 2021. Like, we are a long way from the Million Man March. All of that said, this is very similar to Micah Xavier Johnson. Folks remember in Dallas, 2016, he was the alleged gunman, killed those Dallas police officers, and they used a drone explosive device to terminate Micah Xavier Johnson. And then they said, oh, he was with Professor Griff. Oh, black identity extremist. So I have lots of suspicion about the incident in Washington, D.C. There should be lots of investigation, which will be tough in a week like this, because, I mean, wow, it was event after event after event. So as you get time to settle, that would be an event that I would closely scrutinize. Next, go all the way back to the beginning. Now, talk about white genetic annihilation. When you got all this transgender and the rest of it, that's just, you know, adding to those lack of fertility rates in North America and Europe, i.e. individuals classified as white. But they talked about all that. Big win, transgender individuals are not going to be prohibited from enlisting, which I don't have a problem with at all. What have you. Feel free. Do two tours like Geronimo Pratt. All of that said, they used some comparisons. They said if you have asthma, you may be restricted from serving in the armed services. Gus T. Renegade is not a medical professional. However, I do not have a problem with someone being excluded from the armed services on the grounds of them having asthma. Reason, explanation. I think for some positions in the Army, you might be expected to exert some physical exercise. Depending on the severity of your asthma, that may pose a health risk. I can understand, at least I can thoroughly understand the logic of why that might be grounds for exclusion. And I don't exactly see people out protesting and saying that asthma sufferers should be allowed to enroll. Maybe we can find a desk job for them, which I'm sure they could do. Operate a drone or what have you. All of that said, I do not think that that is comparable to suffering from gender dysphoria. Metaphors, I talk about that all the time. I do not think that is comparable at all. I mean, we're talking about a legitimate health restriction. You could die in this process of being a Marine or whatever it is, whatever branch of service, unless I have been greatly misinformed, there being some confusion about your gender status, that is not going to pose an immediate hazard to your life if you enroll in service. you being mistreated or name called, that's something completely different. And I think they do a lot of that anyway. In fact, pause, I think they've been talking about one of the huge problems in the armed services is racism. And then one of the other ones is sexual abuse. So anybody, have fun, hop to it if you want to join such an organization, and then go kill non-white people, most likely all over the world. Have fun. Let's see. And then in the same report, they said that white people, black people, LGBTQ people, transgender people, all of these people have had similar hurdles. Are you flipping kidding me? Remember when we read Sundown Towns and they talked about the numerous towns throughout the U.S. that had billboards that said, read nigra and run. If you can't read, run. Remember that? I don't remember any such signs that said, look here, LGBTQI, read and run. And if you can't read, run, LGBTQI, If anybody can find even one such town, I'll put some money down right now. I think that'll be another one where you can insert the crickets. Metaphors, continuing. They talked about the reparations program in Evanston. Again, I think my plan is way better. I think if you want to talk about transformation, just say all of the black people, we're going to call it square. It's been so much misdeeds and shenanigans over the years. We'll call it square. All of the Negroes who currently live in Evanston, and or if you have any connection, you can prove to us you have lived here at any time in the last, in the history of Northwestern's existence, because they've had so much what they call it redlining, that they probably haven't even allowed too many black people to live in Evanston. In the history of Northwestern, if you've lived in this area or your ancestors, you can go to Northwestern for free. You talk about transformation. Like, I have a PhD from Northwestern. Now, I'm probably still going to get all kinds of workplace racism and all the rest of it, but I mean, wow. That's not like symbolic or something goofy, or you having all these qualifications for me to maybe get $25,000 towards a house that costs like $1 million. So I'm not even close, but like, just let me go to Northwestern for free as long as it takes. If I want to get a PhD, no problem. Hang out. We got your books, meals, all of that. Hang out, get a degree. That is transformation. We will hook up the Negroes if you are connected to this area of Evanston in any way. That is way better than this little ragtag, you know, low-income housing program. Unless I'm mistaken, I could be totally wrong. But when they start talking about for those who qualify, that's one that I have pause right there, because that I could see a whole lot of whom gets to determine which black people qualify. Is this going to be, you have to give us lots of evidence, same type of thing when you go to the bank, you know, am I going to have to come in here with a DNA sample and get my great grandparents, get them exhumed and get a DNA sample from them? And come on, for $25,000, maybe. Let's see, the segment where they talked about so-called Asian and people classified as black solidarity. I didn't hear a whole lot of talk about anti-blackness and black people being responsible and the focal point for the recent anti-Asian attacks. Maybe I missed that. The metaphor used in that segment, we need to walk and chew gum at the same time. And that was specifically when the interviewer asked, hey, isn't it true that Asian people have more privilege? That word privilege, more privilege than black people. And she talked about being a light-skinned Korean and all that, and then it moved, talk about contempt for gender being queer. I guess victims guarantee qualified, but walk and chew gum at the same time. I just go by the evidence. Individuals black, get back, make it plain. Dr. Francis Cress Welsing, black, get back. Brown, stick around. Mellow, yellow. In a system of white supremacy, we do have a color hierarchy Those who represent the greatest threat to white genetic annihilation are subjected to the worst terrorism classified as niggers. Black people, so-called, worldwide, and are treated the worst. Not saying anybody else is not mistreated. They certainly are, but we're also very explicit about the dynamics hierarchy of white terrorism. As she stated in same thing, if you can find where they had no, what would it be? I guess no chinks here or what have you. That said, I have pointed out repeatedly, Agent Orange, Vietnam. We are reading about Geronimo Pratt, Vietnam veteran. They do mistreat all individuals who are not classified as white. And my end would be Woody Allen. I've said consistently, that right there is anti-Asian violence. Grooming and raping non-white children in areas that white people have destabilized. That is the kingpin of anti-Asian violence right there. And white people don't care about children. Let's see. They had the segment Ripley, Mississippi, where the young black male, he thought that this white person stole his property, which he may have. Well, I guess I can even pause. They said Ripley, Mississippi. I know a beautiful black female investor born in Ripley, Mississippi. It's like, oh, I wonder if she saw this. Anywho, hope it wasn't anyone she knows or related to. That notwithstanding, they said that he went to the residence to like confront this white person, you know, about the stolen property, and then the white person shot him in the head, could have killed him. I have talked consistently for over a year now, avoid public confrontations, skirmishes with strangers, random people in public, particularly white people, male or female. I think the way I've said it consistently is you should be thinking, hey, this person or these people could be armed. I think they included in that report that in Ripley, the white woman apparently got involved too and was attacking him and calling him nigra and the rest of it. And he was trying to defend her off. And that's when the shooting took place, if I heard it correctly. Call the police. If you think you've been robbed or what have you, report the crime. Same way that I say it, I am prepared to kill and die for whatever property I think was stolen. If you're not ready to do that, call the enforcement officials or figure out another plan. It is 2021, very dangerous times, particularly in the U.S. where there's so many guns rampant with so many people. That's just what you should be thinking, particularly if you're going to confront the person at their house. Like, oh my goodness, they might have all kinds of, you should be thinking Stephen Paddock, my man at Las Vegas, like, woof, you're going on their home turf. They might have all kinds of things, nerve gas, and these might be Jeffrey Dahmer's relatives or anything. I'll stop there. Let me see. Many other things I could have talked about. The vaccine passport, I totally think that is going to happen on a broader scale. It's definitely something amidst all of this with Derek Chauvin and all the rest of it should be talked about, thought about. I'll pause there. The number again is 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. You can take about 5 minutes to share your thoughts. Make sure everyone gets a chance to participate. And if you are in a noisy environment, if you could use your mute button, that would be super helpful. Just make sure that we don't have to compete with unnecessary background noise. I picked out a number of different metaphors and curious phrases that were used. If we could refrain from using metaphors, that would be super appreciated. Frequently, race soldiers will use metaphors to generate confusion and or support white supremacy racism. Victims, we've been exposed to this misconduct for decades, minimum, and many of us are still learning. Sometimes we don't have logic to articulate our views, and as such, we will incorporate an analogy, simile, some sort of comparison to share our thoughts. If we could work to be precise, direct, exact with what we want to say, that would be super appreciated. I will prompt about the metaphors. Strive for accuracy. Let's see. First few folks who dialed in, so much. I didn't. I didn't even talk about the shooting in California. It was so much this week. There's so many things I didn't talk about, but the shooting that happened in California, 4 people were killed. Do people think that that was a white person? The shooting in Orange County, I can give out more details if people missed that one. There were many things to miss this week, but do people think that that individual is classified as a white person? I'll get details and all that, maybe even post a photograph if people have not seen or got enough information about that incident from this week. But first few folks who dialed in with a hand up, *61, once again, line should be open. If you have commentary to share, proceed.
May I be heard?
Yes, sir. Greetings, Mr. Blue.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings to all the guests. I'm here with Miss Kaya. Say hello.
Hi, Gus.
Greetings, Miss Kaya. So good to hear from you. She was with us at the retreat. So awesome. I hope you are eating well and resting well, getting quality, excellent rest. That is so important for health.
Absolutely. That and trying to get more better physical condition every day.
Love it. Music to my ears. Love it. Metaphor, but music to my ears.
Yes, indeed. First of all, reparations, or the segment on reparations, I find it very confusing that with a $1.9 trillion vaccine initiative by President, so-called President Biden, that when the conversations prior with Bernie Sanders and Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton and many of the other presidential soon to be candidates or whatnot, that there was always the excuse that there was never enough money to actively devote towards reparations. It was an uncomfortable conversation. We wouldn't know how to dispense it. There would be other ethnicities or races that we would have to also address dealing with reparations. But $25,000 is absolutely an insult, and it will get quite convoluted trying to dole out $25,000 for some type of home or home loan or anything like that when it's such a small amount of money. And when reparations could be taken in the form of tax relief, credit relief, student loan relief for anyone who on their applications filled out Black African American on their taxes, Black African American, it would be so easy to do. Well, not easy, but such a solution that could actually cause, as you said, transformation. But none of that's been considered. But the conversation that now, we can do that for a vaccination, and that the same impetus that the country had and Black Lives Matter had organizing the protests with George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and Michael Brown, that same type of impetus isn't seen as something that we should do to talk about, well, this doesn't sound right. There was no funding for Katrina. There was no $1.9 trillion funding for Katrina victims. There was no $1.9 trillion funding to rectify the Flint, Michigan lead in the water situation. And now this situation with the vaccines, people just are not reacting to it the way that I would thought that non-white Black people would react to it. So I find that interesting and disheartening and disturbing. Having lived in California, which was definitely an experience that just changed the way I saw things, changed a lot of paradigms for me, dealing with the Chicano population, so-called Chicano population, and different groups of Asian people from Thailand, from Vietnam, from Korea, China, Chinese and Japanese, Filipino. I had a chance to talk to a lot of these people, lots of them being classmates or bandmates or fellow artists. There's a within their communities, specifically with their elders who migrated to the Americas, the so-called Americas, that I remember one conversation specific with a Filipino friend of mine, and she told me that her elders told her, and there was a specific mantra, there was a specific idea that when you come to America, do not deal with black men, because black men get women pregnant. And that was the narrative that was perpetuated by American media. And they were told as young women that when you come to America, never get with, never procreate, never have any sexual contact with black men. But in California, one thing that I've noticed is that if any Asian people from whatever country they reside from, if they do not marry someone from their own land, they most often marry someone who classifies themselves as white. And there's also a lot of adoption of Asian individuals by white couples, white families, or white single parents, particularly like in the entertainment field. And that also speaks to the whole adoption and like the Woody Allen incident of like white people adopting non-white children, which I think is an atrocity because it always leads to confusion for that non-white child. As that woman who was speaking in that previous interview, and she did mention that she was queer as an Asian woman, and you know, thinking and representing the LGBTQ Asian community. So I just always find it's just always an interesting conversation when you really get down to speak to people from so-called different ethnicities or so-called races, and you find out what's actually been said to them as far as how they should perceive and relate to non-white black people in particular, and what they've been told by their elders how to relate to us. And the segment, I think Ms. Kaya told me that Mumia Abdul-Jamal had contracted COVID. I didn't hear that segment because my phone went in and out, but I just wanted to know if that's true, because in the 90s, we had definitely protested and signed petitions, and it did much as we could to get his death sentence pardon and the life sentence pardon to no avail. But that would just be sad if that was actually what happened or what is happening to that man. And yeah, this week has been a really intense week. Also with the push for vaccinations here in New York City, a lot of push for vaccinations from television, from all the media. Still the personal phone calls to my mother's home, she being over 80, them suggesting where she can get the vaccination. Even there was a cold call from a health representative that wanted to know her medical records and didn't have her medical records when she gave them some information, but they went as far as to call her house, cold call, to find out who she was and if she was getting the vaccination. After that, I'll mute my line. Thank you very much, Gus, and to all the guests and all the listeners.
Much obliged, Mr. Blue, and Kaya as well, joining in briefly. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have commentary to share, line should be open. Proceed.
Hello,
greetings, Irie in Louisiana. Yes, ma'am.
Hold up. Hope everybody's doing okay. I was debating whether or not I was going to share this because I feel like, I don't know, I just feel like I'm traumatizing other black people sharing the stuff that I see and go through. But then I also really need people to understand, and like you do, Gus, you know, what's going on. And, you know, before I share, it's like I really want to ask again. I think I may have asked it before, but It's like, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? And I know somebody's probably saying, well, we're victims of racism. And, you know, a lot of people are confused. And what are the people like us that are less confused? What are we going to do, you know, other than, you know, be codified and walk these lines, you know, because something has to happen. There has to be some type of action. And it's pissing me off, you know. I hope that's not a cuss word. As far as Asian hate, right now I could give a flying whoop, whoop, whoop. That's a metaphor. Sorry, that was emotional. But I just had a so-called Asian dentist totally disregard me in front of my son when I told her I didn't want fluoride in his body. And I told her why. And she told me, you know, different reasons why I should get it. One reason being that she gives it to her child, and I told her, well, you can do that. I have information that says it's unsafe. I don't want it. If you can't perform the task without fluoride, we'll go. And she completely disregarded me and started talking to my son. My son is not an adult. That's why I was with him, because he's not an adult. And I told her so much, and I said, you know, this is inappropriate and this is unprofessional. And she told me that I was, quote, so disrespectful, so disrespectful. And I told her I was so going to report her, too. So right now, stop Asian hate against us. How about that? I told you all a couple weeks ago that there was a person that was up for confirmation for a high medical position by Joe Biden, and I didn't have the name of the person. I have the name of the person now. That person's name is Rachel Devine, and I hate to tell you, like, again, another metaphor, but that person looks like something off of Hellraiser. A man living like a woman, in my opinion. I guess it's my opinion, but it would be a fact if it was a decade ago. And they asked them point blank, are you going to be letting kids mutilate themselves? You're going to be trying this with street kids and kids with no families. And guess what? Within 2 weeks of sharing that information, I got to see for myself what they are doing to black children in foster care, because I ended up substitute teaching at a foster care educational facility. There is a young boy in fifth grade that they have begun to feminize with something equivalent to risperidone or whatever else they have that they know makes boys grow breasts. He has breasts, and because of that, they gave the boy a girl's shirt. They put a girl's locket on him. They gave him girl's shoes, and they put a scrunchie around him to pull when he's stressed out. That's what he told me. When I asked him where he got these items from, his answer was, oh, I bought it. And then a white female administrator came in and saw him, you know, to check on the class, and then saw him and went, oh, my God, those shoes are hot. If we don't know by now that sexuality, not gender, but sexuality is part of a way is derived from how a child is socialized by now, then I'm saying it. They're socializing children to be mutants. They've mutated this young man because they knew putting him on that psychotropic was going to make him grow breasts. And then they're talking to him like a girl, giving him things to cope with his stress that belong to females. And then someone went as far as to get him a Barbie head. How do I know this? He started purging and volunteering information to me. Oh, Miss Irie, I have a Barbie head. When I go home today, I'm going to braid it. I know how to French braid. I know how to plait. I know how to da-da-da. And I said, well, where'd you get that Barbie head from? That's very interesting. Oh, I bought it. You can't buy anything if you're in the fifth grade and you live in a foster home. So, like I said, I don't know. I'm mad. And, like, things are, it's just really bad. Like, it's causing trouble. And, like I said, my family life, I know it's causing trouble in y'all, so it's like, where does coping stop and action begin? You know, I might be asking for too much. You know, these people, they just ridiculous. They're not, I have one other declaration. I hope I'm not running over. I'm going to try to make it short. White people are not human. They're not homo sapiens. they may be humanoid, but they ain't human. Something about this is not right. It's not working in logic. Human beings don't do this to the planet. They don't do this to themselves, because they do terrorize themselves. Mr. Phillips documents that in his book. And then they terrorize us mostly for sport and for in support of their systems. They got, you know, they're trying to get away from the madness they're causing on Earth. They got space junk flying back down to Earth as they evacuate and leave us with the madness of having to deal with Bill Gates wanting to block the sun, you know, and whatever else he can come up with while they try to pacify us with $1,400 when it's not enough to do anything for people, especially for people that's not working, especially for people who just what it's just whatever. It's just whatever, you know. And I'll mute my line. I'm sorry. I'm sorry for espousing emotions, but that's where I'm at. Yeah, I'm truly a victim. I don't want to be anymore. So thank you. Good night.
Much obliged, Irie. It definitely was a stressful week. I'm so sorry you had to deal with that with your offspring, medical apartheid. Even though I will say, kudos for advocating for your child. Like, that's exactly what that right there is, a huge strategy. Just being able to accompany someone if they have some sort of medical appointment, particularly if you're if it's a child. But just being able to go advocate, you can ask questions. You don't have to have a PhD in the medical profession or be a doctor or anything. Just be able to observe, ask questions. Person might not be feeling well or might be nervous, you know, about the impending procedure. You can just be eyes, ears, and someone to ask a question and there to advocate for that person's well-being. If it's certain procedures or things that you don't want to happen, they can advocate on your behalf. We talk about that a lot with moms who are pregnant. So, outstanding job. The anti-blackness is rife. We have talked about that. In fact, we had an Indian doctor on the program. He was in India, no less, in 2012. Spreads about this time, 2012. About this time, 2012. And we spent an extensive bit of the conversation talking about anti-blackness amongst, I guess they'd be classified as so-called Asian, Indian doctors, non-white, non-black doctors, and how that is a major problem in the system of white supremacy. I guess I'll put it this way, individuals classified as white have been so successful, you even have some black doctors who think and behave in the same manner. And I can just repeat back exactly what I've had to listen to for the last year. Remember old Nurse Rivers? I don't even have to add any more details. Everybody got that. But I mean, it's many more. But I mean, that's just the, if I can metaphor, layup, take the easy ones, low-hanging fruit metaphor, I'll just take the easy one. Nurse Rivers. But it's lots of examples of black doctors who are also, in fact, we had Jessie Daniels. She was on the program. She talked about the medical school experience is rife with anti-blackness, that you pretty much will have to absorb some of that anti-black thought, speech, behavior patterns in order to successfully complete medical school. That notwithstanding, that would not make me feel any better for my child. So in terms of concrete things to do, I think that was your question. I do think self-care is important, because so much of the system of white supremacy racism is about eroding the health and well-being of non-white people in lots of different ways, and having us stressed and then having maladjustments to that stress in lots of different ways, in terms of eating or sleep or just lots of different ways. So I do think that's important. But in terms of other things to do, certainly I think that would be one right there that could be organizing around, if we're in an area where there are black dental professionals or medical professionals who could do a better job of providing care. Let's see if we can organize and get some sort of listing together. That would be something that would be helpful, I guess, to a lot of folks. Might even already exist. That, you know, if it already, such a thing already exists, well then, hey, no need to reinvent the wheel. Metaphor. We can just get right to it. Just seeing what problems, what things need to be addressed right there, and direct things that you're dealing with now in terms of the school situation and effeminization. Hey, white genetic annihilation. Dr. Welsing talked about that. diet, drugs. We talked about that on a number of different programs, I'll say, in the archives, where the chemical, biological impact that that has on the body. I know that was something Dr. Welsing talked about all the time. And I think what she would say frequently, if we want to talk about foster care and all that, I think I can do this one without misquoting. When we play around with sex, the joke is on the offspring. Apparently, that message, forgive the metaphor, has not sunk in terms of we do not have a thorough understanding of why did Dr. Welsing say that so often? Maybe that would be too. See if people can get a better grasp of that and understand this is what's going to happen. We talk about generational impact. Going to every black person can go to Evanston or this so-called housing program. Generational impact with these throwaway children, put that in quotes. Generational impact of white supremacy racism. Getting more parents to think about that and take that seriously, like what Dr. Welsing would talk about with just in terms of how we think about being a parent and the value that we place on a black child, as we talk about the academic program and everything to make sure that that doesn't happen. We have a black child, they are not going to end up in that system where they can just do whatever they want and give them whatever sort of experimental medications and, you know, you're going to be transgender and all the rest of it. And here's a scrungy for you to, I mean, come on. Dr. Welsing, she said, because she didn't just say it once. She said it repeatedly. When you play around with sex, the joke is on the offspring. But those would be two things in terms of suggestions to do. But again, self-care is super important, especially at a time like this. Self-care, I would say, maybe even more critical, because that becomes one of the things that people kind of neglect and put off because there's so much stress and so many things to do. Like, man, self-care is important. Much obliged, Irie. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. Proceed.
Unmuted.
Okay. Proceed. May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Yes, sir. Good evening, Gus. Good evening, Cal's listeners. If I may, I'd like to expand on the advocating for children that you, Irie, was speaking on and you just spoke on. I'm looking for a strategy. Little background. Recently, I started reading Stacey Patton's Spare the Child. Anyway, it led me to a confrontation with my attempted spouse, where she still believes that children should be spanked in order to get them behave. So I'm looking for a strategy, and I'm at my wit's end. I don't want to cause any more problems because I actually physically intervened with her from spanking my grandson. And I was looking for listeners or your insight on how to minimize that conflict, because it seems to her that it's ingrained that they should be able to beat children in order to get them to behave. I'll mute my line to listen. Thank you.
Oh, for sure. I guess you all could read that book together. Wait a minute.
I guess you all could read that book together.
Make sure I'm not echoing. I guess you all could read that book together, maybe, since I know some people do have, joint book reading sessions. That might be one, or you could offer her that book. Don't Beat Black Children, Asada Kirkland. I think she also has a book. She's a black female. She's a guest on the program. Where she talks about the same message and how that's a part of the programming of white supremacy racism. I think the World Health Organization said that under no circumstances, I believe I played this on the program, they upgraded their guidelines. Under no circumstances is any form of corporal punishment acceptable or constructive in child rearing. No circle. Like, I don't care if they stole the car, like, whatever you think the worst, like, they have got to get it this time. Like, the World Health Organization, under no circumstances is that helpful, constructive, beneficial towards child rearing. You could talk about child rearing techniques. Like, you know, is this something that you've like investigated? Like, tell me about it. Like, maybe you know research. Maybe you have information about why you think this is the most effective method for disciplining a child. Like, maybe you do, because there's research that says this is really, really harmful. Like, they even look at you kind of funny about smacking dogs around now. Like, they around here, like, you leave a dog in the car if you want to. They will Michael Vick you as fast as, metaphor, but they will Michael Vick you as fast as they can. You will be in lots of trouble. So you could go the research route. And I got just asking questions like, do you have information about, hey, this is the best way with no side effects. We're not going to have to worry about anything years from now in terms of childhood trauma, what have you. Like, this is the best way to go about child rearing, because there's a lot of data that says that this is the worst. Like, this should not be done under any circumstances. And there are alternatives. Like, we can go that route too. Like, do you have alternatives in terms of other ways, other things that can be done to discipline a child? You know, and how long? I mean, because I mean, if we're talking about this is the discipline technique that we have when this child is five, like, certainly we're going to have some other techniques, because I would think by the time the child is 12, we've talked to some people like, oof, by the time it's 12, they might be bigger than me or stronger, or at least, you know, it might be even, it might, you know, be a little bit more daunting to talk about physical punishment of someone who is, you know, not, you're not towering over that person. So there will have to be some other forms of tech, other strategies for disciplining a child at some point. So just those, and I don't have children. Should have said that at the beginning. I don't have children, but those are some of the things. In fact, I'm going to get that report, because that I thought was really important. The World Health Organization saying explicitly, no circumstances is this constructive. Maybe you have information that they're false, that this is, you know, some sort of conspiracy theory and they just made this up to try to confuse us. Maybe. Do you have data to that effect? That would be one route, maybe just asking questions. If it seems that, and some people, you can also ascertain if this person just has like a commitment, I am about corporal punishment. Like, my parents beat me and they were beaten too, and this is just the best way to do it. I would ascertain that as well. But I would just not. That would just not be acceptable. If it's my child just cannot be beaten. Like, that would have to, we talk about 200 questions. What do you think about corporal punishment? Coon Man outlawed capital punishment in Virginia this month, or last month. I mean, geez, like, we can't be going around lashing people in 2021. Come on. If we have other parents, definitely do not spectate. Make sure you share a thought. If you've had that conversation with yourself, attempted partner, care mate, or whomever else about corporal punishment, you know, do you have to go ahead and get a switch and, you know, go upside somebody's head? Is that the best way to do discipline? We'll pick up other folks we haven't heard from as we go, but parents, make sure you do not spectate. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, proceed.
May I be heard?
Red in Ohio, attempted mommy.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. Hello, everyone. As far as the corporal punishment, I came in like towards the end of that comment. I didn't know that the World Health Organization said that people should not spank their children. I don't know, that's a difficult question, and I definitely agree that that should be one of the many questions that you ask whomever you're going to be making the child with. But I definitely agree that there's some type of punishment needs to happen. But as far as the switch thing, or even an extension cord, which is also something that I've heard of being used to discipline a child, even a belt, especially the type of belt, that could be a bit much. But I can't say that I'm completely against it. Like a SWAT, like on the bottom, like if they're like a toddler. Now, as far as like once they get older, there's definitely, I'm definitely planning on transitioning as far as like taking a cell phone away or TV or whatever, things like that, because fighting a child, that's, I think that it would actually come to that if, you know, the child is finally, you know, your same height or whatever. So that's my comment on that. Other thing I wanted to share was that this week, prior to this week, I got a jury summons, and this week I did go. It's actually in Ohio. It's an on-call process, so they'll send you out a message if they need you, and you're on call for a couple of weeks. And the day that they actually meet you, then they'll tell you when to go in. And unfortunately, I did actually get there, but I did not get to go to trial because the defendant, he actually pled out instead of, I guess, what he originally wanted to do was have a trial by jury. But while I was there, the jury commissioner, the guy who sends out all of the messages, apparently he used to be a comedian. And so he had said that he would work on his jokes on like the prospective jurors. And so he was telling jokes most of the time, but he did also share some different stories about just dangerous things that had happened at the courthouse. So it made me think about security and sometimes how we can be lax despite the fact of there being like wands and different metal detectors, which is something that I had to walk to. I actually had to walk through two of them, which was kind of odd. You would think that what am I going to get between the second metal detector after I passed through the first one. But the main thing that I found very, very interesting is that with the jury process, so many people are called down. I think it's about 20. About 20 people are supposed to show up, but of course, some people, they still don't. I was very excited. But when I got there, it was just the demographics of the prospective jury pool. Of the 18 people that were there, 10 of them were white women. Five of them were white men. That's 15. And then there were only three people who would be classified as black, me being one of them. There was also another black female, and then a person, I feel like he was likely a black male. He didn't seem like he was biracial. So I thought that was very interesting. And I forgot exactly everything that was said, but there was a lot said because we were there for a few hours. The Chauvin case that did come up, and as far as demographics, when the commissioner, he was talking about the demographics of the jury, he had said, I don't know if this is for Ohio, if he only meant Ohio or nationwide, he had said in 1994, it was the phrase like being judged by a jury of your peers was no longer in law or something like that. It's actually, the jury has to reflect the demographics of, I guess, where the trial is going to be held, which I thought that's very interesting, which makes sense why there would still be all white trials. If you move a trial to an area where it's possibly like an all white on purpose town, then that's why you would get an all white jury. And I'll mute my line. Thank you for allowing me to share.
Much obliged, Red in Ohio. Potential jury duty. My goodness. She gave us the demographics. They generally find ways of excluding black people from participating in those sorts of jury trials and experiences. That right there can give you a lot to learn about the system of racism, white supremacy too. In terms of the parenting aspect, that's one study. There are lots of things can be done in the buildup, like studying and thinking about, like, yeah, what are we gonna do? Like, you know, he steals the car, you know, what do we do? How do we diss him? We go get a switch, an electric cord, like she said, and beat him? Or, you know, what do we do? Like, thinking about that, do we have the same disciplinary procedure at 5 if we do at 12? Like, those 200 questions, it should encompass a lot in terms of child rearing and thinking about that. That's why I do not have children. Like, whew, man. So, number of reports on... Let's see. So the World Health Organization, they have a report: severe physical punishment, risk of mental health problems for poor urban children in Brazil. I'm not going to read the whole thing. Corporal punishment is associated with mental health problems during childhood and adolescence. It goes on to give more of the statistics. Separate report: end all corporal punishment of children, prohibiting and eliminating corporal punishment, a key health issue in addressing violence against children. And this is a response paper to a World Health Organization initiative on the same topic. I'm not reading the whole thing, just the summary. Corporal punishment, violence inflicted on children by parents, teachers, and carers, and others in the name of discipline, is the most common form of violence against children. It violates children's right to respect for their human dignity and physical integrity, as well as their rights to health, development, and education, and is associated with a wide range of negative health, developmental, and behavioral outcomes for children that can follow them into adulthood. It legally violates children's rights to equal protection under the law. And they go on to talk about the World Health Organization's involvement in this and their effort to eliminate this globally, corporal punishment. And just as I was surfing to try to locate the World Health Organization's position on this, the New York Times, 2018, end of the year, November, spanking is ineffective and harmful to children, pediatricians group says. Parents should not spank their children, the American Academy of Pediatrics said on Monday in its most strongly worded policy statement, warning against the harmful effects of corporal punishment in the home. The group, which represents about 67,000 doctors, also recommended that pediatricians advise parents against the use of spanking, which is defined as non-injurious open-handed hitting with the intention of modifying child behavior, and said to avoid using non-physical punishment that is humiliating, scary, or threatening. One of the most important relationships we all have is the relationship between ourselves and our parents, and it makes sense to eliminate or limit fear and violence in that loving relationship, said Dr. Robert D. Sage, a pediatrician at Tufts Medical Center and the Floating Hospital for Children in Boston, and one of the authors of the statement. I can post these, but it goes on. It has lots of data. I think we even talked about this with Dr. Tommy Curry in the archives. But yeah, I think no constructive value to placing hands, switch, extension cord, belt, none of the above, no constructive value to that at all. There are much better disciplinary techniques in 2021. Anachronistic parenting, how about that? Other folks, again, parents should not spectate. If you have commentary to share, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Greetings. Retired firefighter in Miami.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings to everyone. Yes, I am totally against physical reaction to with a child. Not saying that I am perfect. I have made mistakes. Nothing that I would deem as severe. the person that I participated in to his birth is still staying under the same roof with me. he's not in the house right now. He left to go somewhere. But I have made mistakes along the way. But and I actually had that form of punishment myself. But in my opinion, I don't think that it works. I don't think it works. I think what works is the individual, quote unquote, in this case, child, comes to realize that some things that they have done incorrectly would be letting down the care group, call a family, and themselves. And when they come to that maturity is when they improve. But a lot of times parents do it because they run out of words, primarily. That's primarily what the physical reaction comes after running out of words, running out of how to communicate with another person, and they become frustrated. And because they have mental and physical sometimes power over a child, then they utilize that form of treatment. And it does not work, in my opinion. Someone mentioned about more doing, or I think it was that, or something like that. It was a mail call, I think, that mentioned something about with mentoring with black males. I think that's important. That would be more than just talking, and have more about doing. And it could be organized. It could be organized with males or females. It doesn't take a whole lot. A lot of people, a lot of black people especially, are looking for assistance to be able to assist them into with their particular child, whether it's male or female. As far as what I just happen to work with in a situation with black male children. Been trying to improve upon my participation in the mentoring group, and just thinking about from the standpoint of something audio visual, something that the young fellas can identify with, that was came out within the last 20 years, not 50 years ago, where it had some sort of success other than sports. Other than sports, we don't need another basketball player. We don't need another football player. And I've been involved with this sport for a very long time. We don't need another one, you know, at all. We don't need another athlete, period. We do need doctors. We do need, especially doctors like Dr. Wellesley. We definitely need more of those. We do need more attorneys. We do need more teachers. That's for sure. And a lot of other things that have to do more with the base of people progressing. A program like a mentoring program can establish a base. I thought about, I was telling somebody on the Kyles about a situation with a possible example of a black male. This is before I had the idea of not really entering in sports, of a black male who basically was charged with raping a female, and at the same time he was awarded with a scholarship to go to University of Southern California. I forgot his name. They've done movies on this person. On a football scholarship. And this is before I made this declaration that I don't want to even entertain sports at all. But it did qualify to me because the person that was identified as the person who lied about being raped happened to be a black female. And I don't want to bring that in front of the young fellas. But I'm still looking around for something that is within the, in the 21st century that shows, gives some examples, so it would initiate conversation amongst them to each other. And the only thing that we would do as a so-called adults would just kind of like maybe referee to a point of keeping the conversation flowing in a constructive manner. And they talk, you know, talk it out with each other over what they saw. And basically something short enough that would keep their attention span also. And those are some of the things that I have been thinking about this week. And thanks for everybody for listening.
Much obliged, retired firefighter in Florida, Miami specifically. That's awesome in terms of looking for content for the young folks. That's, I guess, that they can relate to. It's they got tons of films out now on all kinds of subject matter and people. Just would depend on, I don't know what they're interested in. I guess you could ask them too if there are any projects that they're interested in that they'd like to watch, that they've heard about, that maybe they haven't seen, that they think would be interesting, because they might, you know, have already seen some things that they think would be interesting. For some reason, Disgraced came to mind. That's a documentary where it is about athletics, but it would be thinking about athletics in a different way. Like, it would take away some of the luster and, you know, the appeal of being able to go out and be, you know, a big star athlete and maybe going to college and all that. Like, these are the things that can happen to black male athletes in all of this. It's really good. It's directly about racism, white supremacy.
The name of it is what?
Disgraced. It's about the Baylor basketball team, and a black male was killed on the Baylor basketball team, and in a really just tacky and disgraceful manner. And it looked like the white basketball coach lied about it and covered up this information and just quieted it up, and they get to roll on. And it talks about how much money. Yeah, it's really, really interesting. That might be one where I think they could have a lot of discussions. I thought it was really, really important. And workplace racism, because they try to get a black male employee to lie. Like, they call him in, he uses it. Yeah, it's fast. I thought it was fascinating. I thought of that. I thought of Concussion, kind of in the same vein, with Will Smith. That's not a doubt. Well, it's based on a true story, as they say, which would provide a lot of opportunity, because the whole story that that's based on, Dr. Omawalu, I'm sure I'm messing his name up, my apologies. But the black doctor who Will Smith portrays in Concussion, based on a real person, he talked about racism, white supremacy. There are articles written where he's saying that that was a major problem, and him not being able to get his data accepted quicker about CTE and the brain damage that these, many of them black male athletes, were experiencing. So that was another one. And because it's based on a true story and y'all could follow, and oh, who's this? And talk about, we need doctors. This is why we need doctors. It was a black doctor who was the one who saw how black males were being harmed severely with all of this. So that one came to mind, especially if they're into sports. And then also Game Changer, Dr. Ruby Lathan, she recommended that one. That's just about athletes of all different types. And them switching to a plant-based diet and still being great. There are professional football players in it, professional basketball players, Olympic athletes, bodybuilders, weightlifter, professional weightlifters, like the whole gambit, and just talking about how it improved their performance. I think even some UFC fighters and all the rest. So they can see that and just the impact. And it goes into the science of how what you eat impacts your body, and how getting away from meat, just being conscious about what you eat, can enhance your performance as an athlete. So that one might be great, just if nothing else, to get them to think twice about eating Cheetos, maybe drink a little bit more water, less sugar. Those are three that came to mind, and those are all pretty, I think all of those came out no later than 2015, I believe. Yeah, all of those are pretty new. I'll have to give it some more thought though, but asking them, that might, because they might have some thoughts as well. Other folks who dialed in, we haven't heard from. If you have commentary, proceed.
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, Gus, listeners and callers. Comment for the gentleman that asked the question in regards to abuse and some help, hopefully. I went through the same process, separated from my son's mother. The best for the situation that occurred, I did end up with custody by obviously going to court, but there were many times I had to maintain that due to certain circumstances that were happening within both our households. That being said, I ended up getting a psychologist, a black psychologist, from our neighborhood. So it was very helpful, and it actually allowed my son space to speak about the physical abuse, and actually then gave him a little bit more power because he had the words to actually use to express, you know, what was going on. And this helped me, obviously, later on gain full custody of my son. That's one thing. The second thing I'd say is also try to recall, and this may sound a little odd, but I think it's useful where going back in the past sometimes and try to recall other family members or even your own situations where you were hit and how did you feel and how to actually make a connection with the child so that they understand that, you know, you've been through it too and you're trying to do better by doing what you're doing for them. So it's a tricky one. And this touches really home for me because of that and because this is also something that one of my family members went through. And because he went through that, he suffered enormous learning disabilities. And, you know, till this day, it's something that I don't think their family, that side of the family chooses to discuss. But it definitely, pardon the metaphor, rears its ugly head on certain occasions, family get-togethers. So it's difficult. But if you persevere and just really try to get the child resources as well as try to understand where the child comes from, there can be some more healing in that process. Only other thing, and it's just whatever, it's lighten it. I was kind of disappointed Dr. Mills didn't respond back, but hey, I did watch With the Health. I then followed him a little bit because I was like, it's a black man and not a white man. And yeah, it is what it is. But I did get great information from Bosch when she came on. I do cycle as well, so it's good to pick a brain sometimes of a white person to gather some more data so you could become better and more efficient at whatever you do. That being said, I'll mute my line. Thank you for your time. Peace.
White guests only. I was hoping to talk to Dr. Milton Mills as well, but hey, the system of white supremacy is not about liking. Much obliged as well for sharing on the damage of corporal punishment and spanking or whatever, you know, terms people want to put on it. It is not constructive and can have really long-term traumatizing effects on people, how they parent, how they behave and function with other people, even the relationship with their parents around that. I mean, just nothing constructive at all. Other folks have a hand up that we missed totally.
Can I be heard?
Our caller in Florida? Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners and callers. I remember hearing a metaphor also that was used. I think when the segment about the incident at the Capitol with the black male victim, I think that was a white person. They said that, I guess they were trying to make a comparison, said something about the scab, I guess. Yeah, like the scab has been taken off after what happened back on January 6th. I think that's what they were trying to say. And I said, man, that's another interesting, because there's so much like what I've been focusing on is just the words and the language. And I agree with the victim in Louisiana about the solution aspect. And this program definitely, once again, you know, I just want to reiterate that it's really been having me go in the most constructive direction, if I could put it that way, trying to be accurate. It would just keep in focus on the language, diet as well. But like the way that you speak to people, and I can't really speak with a lot of my own family with about this type of thing. And I know a lot of people can relate to that. And it's going to take them time to develop an understanding about the system of white supremacy. And I think not just the people on this line, it's a lot of people, a lot of black people, non-white people, who are talented and have the skill in whatever area of activity to come up with concepts and can do and say things to help come up with a solution to the system of white supremacy. And the segment with Mr. Fuller, where he was speaking about the non-white victims classified as Asian, that was an interesting segment. I've been thinking about how it's like the races have been very skilled with how they have been able to keep the different classifications of non-white people in certain areas where we only seem to, I won't say only, but a lot of the time seem to have interactions that might not be the most constructive. And I've noticed that for the most part of my life. So I can contribute that to the system of white supremacy. So I'm just trying to just continue to be in deep thought about what ways I can come up with to help come up with a means to have better communication, especially with other black people, but with other victims as well, more extensively. And that's all I have to share right now. And thanks for allowing me to speak.
Much obliged, caller in Florida. I do recall that metaphor being used in the segment on the incident in D.C. This ripped the scab off, talking about the incident in January, the white terrorist capital siege at the beginning of the year. They did invoke that metaphor. But yet words are very important in trying to make an assessment. And I think even what he said, he didn't say he was having difficulty talking about racism, white supremacy with other non-white people classified as Asian. He said he was having difficulty talking with his own family members. I have heard that dozens of times easily. I can upgrade scores of times over the years where all over the world, people classified as black have said the exact same thing. Where it's been a black female, I can't talk about this with my so-called husband, black male, I can't talk about this with my attempted care mate, so-called wife, regular, can't talk about this with my so-called parents or siblings or whatever it is, sometimes offspring, whatever it is. That is very, very common within the system of white supremacy. Nothing about this promotes quality relationships between people, anybody. On rampant display throughout the known universe. Let's see. Any folks we missed that commentary that they want to make sure they get in? Great. Didn't miss anybody. Got all the folks who had commentary. We'll be here for Dr. Gerald Horn Monday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Any other folks' commentary that they made to make sure they get in before we wrap things up? Sure, they're Easter Sunday.
May I be heard, Doug?
Yeah.
Mr. Blue first, and then we can get retired firefighter. Mr. Blue.
Thank you. Thank you, retired firefighter. Thank you, Gus. Just lastly, I'd like to say to all the callers, if you are thinking about getting the vaccination, me and my sister had a conversation. She is in the medical field. She did attend medical school until the system of racism, white supremacy, and their agents within the school made her feel so uncomfortable and terrorized her that she eventually left and she started a career in cosmetic surgery. But the one thing that we did talk about, she did recently get the vaccination. And with vaccinations, if you get the first vaccination, do not get the second vaccination. Get the first vaccination, get your card or whatever they sign for you to say that you got your vaccination. But how it works with biochemistry and vaccinations and everything is that, and this is with my limited knowledge, but me and her have talked for a long while, and I read some, but I am a victim. The first vaccination
30 seconds
is a primer.
So this can't be, you know, super long.
No. And the second vaccination is a catalyst. So the first vaccination will test your body. The second vaccination will form a catalyst. And a lot of people do get sick or receive side effects from the first vaccination from their body getting used to whatever agent they've put into their body. So just be careful. If you do have to get the vaccination or you want to get it, just get the first one. Don't get the second one. I mean, my line. Everybody stay safe.
Retired firefighter in Florida.
Yes, very, very short. To all future parents or parents with minor children, you know, the advent of a male parent, attempted parent with a female child. I mean, what do you do when it comes to corporal punishment? I would not put my hands at all on my female child at all. I mean, it's just absolutely ridiculous. And then they have programs. They have programs and programs that you can organize with relating with your children, with other attempted parents. There's no such thing as whooping school. So, yeah, that's all I have to say. Thank you. You're logical.
Whooping school, my goodness. I have to check to see if they have that. Does anybody have a PhD from whooping school? Got my master's in spanking. Like, maybe they have. I haven't heard it before, but I'm still learning too. The book just published this year, Countdown, two words, Countdown, How Our Modern World is Threatening Sperm Counts, Altering Male and Female Reproductive Development. Irie was talking about that earlier, right? And imperiling the future of the human race. No such thing, but very eager to read. Dr. Welsing, she would have this. I know she would be reading this. Say, y'all should read it right now. Right now. That is exactly why that's exactly why the George Floyd trial, that's in the ISIS papers, justifiable homicide, that is it exactly. White genetic annihilation. And I mean 2060, that's less than 40 years. That right there is reason enough. Eat really healthy. We could conceivably be here in 40 years where it's alleged 60% of the male population, probably those classified as white, will be infertile in less than 40 years. Something to think about in the system of white supremacy racism, maybe greater forces helping to solve the problem. Dr. Gerald, I know folks, Dr. Gerald Horn had better be here Monday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. We are not messing around. Had us all excited for last Wednesday, and then he wasn't here. The Bittersweet Science should be here for Monday, April 5. Tomorrow, April 4, important day for other reasons, but we'll be here in about 48 hours. Much obliged to everyone who participated. Hope we did not miss any. I guess, can I confirm really quick, and then we can sign out. Mo in Dallas, all you have to do is give me a yay or nay. I think I did remember correctly. Did you say you didn't change your mind, but you were going to go ahead and consider when we got the information about obesity and how much to blame an individual is? You did not say that you changed your mind. You just said you would give it some more thought. Is that correct? I'll just get an answer to that quickly, and then we can conclude.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Well, I have changed my mind on obesity. It has a lot to do with me understanding why I'm not obese, believe it or not. I always considered my personal health, just my health, and then looking at my family, I understand it has a lot to do with my lineage and the fact that I come from a long background of I guess I don't want to talk, you know, or short my ancestors, but kind of like, you know, backwood herbalists, if you will. My grandparents and you know, their parents before them always practiced and kind of gardening for themselves and producing their own vegetation and whatnot. And I think it has a large effect on my metabolism, the metabolism of my children, and things like that. And I just thought my family was just like naturally healthy and fit. And then when you take a look at the stock, it had a lot to do with who created us in the long run. If I could, as far as corporal punishment goes, a retired firefighter mentioned about what do you do when you're a male with a female child. I do have a female child. I am the custodial parent of the female child, and it's very, very, very difficult to practice or institute corporal punishment on my daughter. It's like, it's so much so to where I think she knows. We do a lot of talking, a lot of questions with both of my children, just to make like, and I do a lot of questioning the intent that they had when they committed an act. And I also ask them constantly if there's something that they don't understand. Sometimes I'll just catch them at random, like, do you have any questions for me? Because my kids have a saying and they know it. No one hits my kids. Not even their mothers are allowed to strike them. And their mothers know it. And their mothers know that I'm serious about that. It does do damage. And one of the previous callers stated that, you know, kids, you know, put yourself in the mindset of a child. I remember being smaller and just thinking about how large an adult actually was when I was a child. And it wasn't until I was a full grown man till I realized my grandfather was only 5'4". He was the scariest man like growing up, you know, but to realize that like corporal punishment was his thing, was a thing. It wasn't only his thing, but it was definitely a thing. And it was just very traumatizing. Thank you. I'm in my line.
No, big no to corporal punishment. You can put that still learning for both. Corporal punishment, I guess we're all still learning about best parenting techniques. Racist man, racist woman. The collective parents of the known universe are not quality models. but still learning there, and certainly with nutrition, still learning. The book that we read, you are what your grandparents ate. Thankfully, some of our grandparents ate a little bit better, so we might be in a better position. Hopefully we can say that yes, we were not eating McDonald's and Twizzlers and Cheetos. We were drinking, like caller in Florida, we were doing a gallon and a half of water with no lead in it, uncontaminated, hasn't been placed on the floor, and then eating fresh quality plant-based meals daily. Get a little exercise in, and maybe we'll be here in 2060 to see what does a world look like where perhaps 60% of the white males in North America and Europe are infertile. Countdown indeed. We'll be here Monday. Dr. Gerald Horn. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. Promoting health. Drink more water. In addition to being sober, let's be buckled every time we are in a vehicle. Again, we didn't even talk about the shooting in California. They had the incident in D.C. Very suspicious. Investigate. The shooting in Georgia, the shooting in Colorado that wasn't that long ago. Very dangerous times on the plantation. I would be mindful. If you're going to go out, be very alert about what's happening around you. Not a time to be in verbal confrontations with strangers. You should be thinking, this gal, this guy, they may be armed. White person, non-white person, they may have a whole group waiting. They're also armed, ready to do harm. Be very risk averse. If you gotta go out, you're buckled. Sober. If you're driving, you're not on the cell phone. We need all of our attention. Make sure we're in a safe surrounds. And then we need to be, as best we can, minimizing contact with the Mark Furmans, Derek Chauvins of the known universe. With that, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. No name calling, easy one. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in. Maybe no name calling, no corporal punishment. Cal signing out.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my condition.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.